Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Edward Martin attended the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, and while there, he was actively involved with parachuting, archery, mountaineering. At the age of 21, he made his first overseas trip to Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda. And while in Alaska, after graduating from UAF with a Bachelor of Arts degree in speech communications, he became a Peace Corps volunteer, teaching English as a second language in Afghanistan. And while in Asia, he traveled in Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Nepal. During his travels in India, he researched the subject of Jesus in India and found a surprising amount of historical evidence and folklore. Later, he moved to the South Pacific as a Peace Corps volunteer for 2 years in the Fiji Islands. And during that time, he traveled through Fiji, New Zealand, Australia. And after leaving Fiji, he lived for 1 year in Japan, where he taught English and studied the martial arts. He has also taught English for 1 year in Saudi Arabia and later in Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan. In the United States, he has worked as a teacher, a newspaper reporter, a photographer, and as the manager of a publishing company. He is an avid student of religion, spirituality, history, foreign cultures. He is a gifted linguist, and he speaks seven languages. Currently, he owns and operates a publishing business and conducts adventure tours to remote sites that he has been throughout the world. My pleasure to bring in Edward Martin. Hello, Edward. Welcome to Coast.
Hi, George. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. Seven languages. Tell me, which ones are they?
Well, after English, Spanish language, and then after that, Persian, which is called Farsi, mm-hmm. and also a pretty fair amount of Japanese, and also some Hindi, and then after that, some Swahili, and, some Fijian, too. I don't use the Fijian too much.
Now, where's that from?
From Fiji. Fiji Islands in the South Pacific.
Okay. Do you sometimes, because you know so many languages, mix them up accidentally?
Sometimes a little bit, that I kind of put my mind like playing one track on a record player. And like if I want to say something in Japanese, I kind of put my mind on that track or so on like that. Fijian, I don't get to use it too much. Farsi, incidentally, that Marco Polo used Marco Polo and his father and uncle, Niccolo and Matteo, that in their journey from Venice, and they went to Acre, and all the way from Acre on the coast of Israel all the way across to China, it was a lingua franca that they used very much. So it's been that way with me, too, that Farsi, Persian, is very useful.
You know, I've never heard of Fijian, though. I always thought that they probably spoke Japanese or Chinese.
In the Fiji Islands in the South Pacific?
Uh-huh.
In Fijian, it's a labiodental language in the Polynesian language family. And if you wanted to hear some of it, for example, the greeting is Nisambula, and the answer, Mula Vinaka, Osalakueve, where are you going? Aulakumana Sitoa, I'm going to the store, and so on like that. It's a beautiful language. The national song there is called Isalei, and it's about a farewell to a traveler. It's a beautiful language.
Amazing. How many languages are there on this planet, Edward? What do you think?
I've heard the figure through the Berlitz Language School. I've heard the figure of around 2,000, if you count all the dialects.
Jeez.
And approximately about 2,000. Incidentally, Latin is fascinating. You mentioned about the upcoming Mel Gibson movie in Latin and Aramaic.
Mm-hmm.
That Latin is a wonderful language. I studied Latin for 2 years in high school, and then studied 2 years of Spanish, and Latin has helped me a lot. It's a very useful language, and also the Aramaic that later, if you'd like, we'll talk about the Talmud of Emmanuel document and about the Aramaic language and the translation of that and so on.
Sure. Afghanistan. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about it, but the fact that you were there, you might be able to shed a little insight for us. Tell me about your impressions when you were out there.
Well, being in Afghanistan is sort of like going back to 13th century Constantinople. It's like time travel. Afghanistan is an amazing, incredible place. The things that that I saw in Afghanistan just would be amazing things. I saw things like I saw sword fights. I saw things like a man was riding a camel. He got angry at the camel and got off the camel and pulled out a sword and cut the camel's head off and then, cut it up and sold the meat on the spot. And he had a lot of buyers. That Afghanistan is a turbulent, exciting, profound place. And the way things are now, it's a mix of the new technology, cell phones and so on like that, right along beside things like blacksmiths using bellows and technology that's 2,000 years old technology. You'll see people making nails like the square handmade nails that are made. They're four-sided nails, which are the same kind of nails used in the crucifixion and seen in the stigmata, like of Therese Newman of Connersruth, Bavaria, back in the 1930s and so on. And there's just so many fascinating things. But Afghanistan is also a profoundly beautiful country. I was very saddened by the news of about a year and 6 months ago when the Taliban blew up the statues at Bamiyan, the giant Buddha statues, more than 200 feet tall. There were the two huge ones, and I had been there several times as a Peace Corps volunteer. It was a marvelous place, and of course it was a world art treasure, which unfortunately was destroyed.
Knowing the terrain out there, Edward, I'm amazed that it took the Soviets 10 years to try to combat the Afghanis, and they were unable to, and we seem to have swept through in just a matter of months.
Yes, the situation basically, as I understand, was that the Soviets wanted to annex Afghanistan. And, of course, the Afghan people, it's been said about the Afghan people that they are the fightingest people on earth, and they love nothing better than to fight. And, for example, if the Afghans have no foreigners, they love to fight foreigners best of all, but if they have no foreigners to fight, they'll pick a fight among themselves, like two Afghan tribesmen, there'll be a couple of birds light on a fence, and they'll say which one is going to fly first, and whichever one flies first, the other one starts to fight. And there are feuds that go on. There are medieval-type stone and mud forts in many parts of Afghanistan, and feuds between clans. Fascinating things happen. That a good friend of mine, his father is a medical doctor there in Afghanistan, and he was visiting one of the tribal chiefs in one of the fortresses there, and a fight broke out with a rival clan, and the chief's son got hit in the chest with a bullet, and the doctor he was up for it and just did the surgery, opened up the man's chest with just very primitive things that he had in his satchel. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting story that they had to, it took the one man was holding the lantern, it was at night, as he was cutting the chest open, taking the bullet out, and the man collapsed from all the blood, watching the blood. They brought in another man to hold the lantern, and he collapsed too, and they brought in a third one and blindfolded him, and he held the lantern, and the man survived. But Afghanistan, it's a marvelous place. The Afghan people are wonderful people. I love the Afghan people. They are very kind-hearted to people who treat them well. It's a physically beautiful place, and I'm really looking forward to the time in the future, in the near future, when visitors will be able to freely go back and travel within Afghanistan. It's a marvelous place.
When you were traveling Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Nepal, at what point did you start getting interested in the life story of Jesus, or did you go there with that intention?
I went there with that intention, and just to explain briefly, as a child growing up in a small town here in Texas, the town of Lampasas, that there were old movies that would be on television, for example, Gunga Din, King of the Khyber Rifles, various old movies about India, and I was just riveted by those. I just loved those movies, especially about British soldiers in India, and I was keenly fascinated by that, and I didn't know why, and I couldn't understand it, but I knew I was fascinated by India, and I promised myself that I would go there. And then when I was 18 years old and I was starting to go to school in Abilene, Texas, and what happened was I met a young man from Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which is the same place Edgar Cayce was from.
Oh, yes.
And I think many of your listeners will know who Edgar Cayce is. I can give a website later about the Cayce organization. But this young man from Hopkinsville, Kentucky, he told me about Edgar Cayce, and I had made some kind of a comment there, even though I was raised as a fundamentalist Christian. I believed then and still believe now in reincarnation. And I made some comment about reincarnation, and some of the other young men laughed. But this young man from Hopkinsville, Kentucky, he didn't laugh. And so we went to the stairwell in the dorm where we could talk privately, and he said, "Have you ever heard of Edgar Cayce, who was the greatest..."
I call him the American prophet.
Exactly, the American prophet. And that Cayce at first did not believe in reincarnation either. Cayce found that, as you know, he could go into a deep trance and help people with medical problems. And then, but the Cayce readings tell numerous times that during the missing years of Jesus, between the age of 12 and 30, that many years of that time were spent in India studying from the very spiritually advanced men and women, the great gurus, the great teachers. And that's what got me interested. And then I later found a marvelous book called The Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ by Levi Dowling, who was a chaplain in the Union Army in the Civil War. And Levi Dowling's marvelous book, that the information that comes from the Akashic Records, that Levi Dowling, like Edgar Cayce, was able to go into a self-trance and contact the Akashic Records, which the Hindus describe. Edgar Cayce also contacted the Akashic Records. The Hindus describe that as being like a gigantic tape recorder, which records every thought, word, and deed that has ever taken place on the earth plane.
Yes. All right. With that search, I'm going to ask you something, because it's a question that not a lot of people can answer directly. Who do you think Jesus was?
To tell you a concise kind of an answer, that my understanding from the materials from the Billy Meyer case in connection with the Pleiadians, that they explain that more than 2,000 years ago, they went to a distant star system in one of the outer arms of this Milky Way galaxy, a planetary system called Lawson. Now, the human souls on Lawson are very spiritually advanced. They're up at a level where they exist as bundles of spiritual energy, and kind of like 8 or 10 or 12 of these advanced souls in a kind of a ring or group, and that the people from the Pleiades went to that planetary system Lawson with the advanced souls. They described the situation on Earth, and they said that every 2,000 years at the beginning of each new age on the Earth, they want the creational teachings to be the true spiritual teachings, the true knowledge to be taught in its completeness and its correctness at the beginning of each age. And in other words, they were asking for a volunteer willing to come to Earth. One of the souls in one of those soul groups, 8, 10, 12 souls, was a spiritually advanced soul who volunteered to come here to the Earth. And then that soul, by agreement with Mary, the mother of Jesus, that soul became the one that we know as Jesus Christ, which, incidentally, that in the Talmud of Emmanuel, it's explained that in his lifetime, the only name he was known by was Emmanuel, which that ties in with the ancient prophecy in Isaiah and the statement in the early part of Matthew that says that she shall bear a child and his name shall be Emmanuel, which means God with us.
Wow. I thought my discussion with you tonight, Edward, was going to be just a pure little discussion about Jesus. It's going to be much more than that tonight, isn't it?
Much more. And one of the other souls in that advanced group, incidentally, is Billy Meyer's soul, which he doesn't come out and flaunt that. But anyway, that was to tell you the truth about it. And incidentally, a further thing, the biological father of Emmanuel, according to the Pleiadians and their knowledge, was one of the Pleiadian commanders named Gabriel. And I can tell you more about that later.
Okay, now let's real quickly, too. Some people know the name Billy Meyer. Tell us who he is.
That Billy Meyer is a gentleman in Switzerland. He's at Hinterschmidruti in Switzerland. And I first found out about Billy Meyer during the latter part of the 1980s that I was reading in the UFO News Clipping Service out of Plumerville, Arkansas. I was reading UFO News, and I was reading about a book review of a book called Light Years by Gary Kinder, which is a marvelous book, and you can still find it in used bookstores and other places. But Light Years by Gary Kinder is a scholarly investigative report about the Billy Meyer case. Billy Meyer is an individual who, from the age of 5 years old, that at the age of 5 years old in 1942, that Billy and his dad, they saw a silvery hovering disc, a silvery UFO in the daytime. So Billy was 5 years old. He asked his dad, "What's that?" And his father said, "Ah, it's one of Adolf Hitler's war machines." And it later flew off. And Billy didn't think that was true. And then what happened shortly after that was that Billy at night got a telepathic impulse to go out behind the house into the forest. He did. And there was a craft, a silvery UFO craft that was landed in the clearing. And there was a kindly looking elderly man who motioned toward Billy to come close to him. And the elderly man was named Svoth. And Svoth is from the Pleiades. And the contacts went on from there. Svoth was his teacher for 11 years, and that the Pleiadians attached great importance to 11-year cycles, which, incidentally, the Edgar Cayce material also says that for our planetary system, there is a significance about 11-year cycles. And incidentally, tying in with that, the sunspots, you may know, run in 11-year cycles.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Now, you are a very educated man. You are an extremely well-traveled man. Do you believe the Billy Meyer case?
Yes, I do. I tell you what, when I first found out about the Billy Meyer case, when I read that book review about light years, I thought, well, an uneducated, or in our terms, not well-educated formally, and a man who ran away from school as a youngster and had these claimed UFO sightings, I thought, well, it's probably a hoax. And then I thought, well, I'll read Light Years, and I will talk with people and investigate and make up my own mind. And I'll put it this way, that I have read and researched everything that I can find, everything I can get a hold of about the Billy Meyer case, and I am friends with one of Billy Meyer's three children, Methuselah, and I've traveled to Switzerland. I've gone there to Hinderschmidruti. I've talked with people in the area, and seen the, incidentally, a couple hundred yards above their house, the Swiss government, charmingly, they bought a piece of land. Of course, land is expensive in Switzerland,
but they've got
a weather research station up there, 200 yards above the house, where they can watch things. But I can give you some more information later that concerning the research of Wendell Stevens, who's the main researcher. I talked with Wendell a couple of nights ago on the phone, and just basically about the Billy Meyer case, that for those who don't know much about it, it's easy to dismiss it out of hand. A big part of the material about the Meyer case, it's important that we have free will, and therefore it's important that we have plausible deniability. For people who are not ready for the information, they shouldn't be forced.
We'll talk more about that with my guest, Edward Martin. He's written a fascinating book called King of Travelers, Jesus' Lost Years in India. And how does this all tie in together? Well, stick around. You'll find out. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Mr. Edward T. Martin, my guest, as we talk about the life of Jesus. Let's talk for a moment, Edward, if we can. Now, let's put Billy Meyer aside for a moment. How did you tie in these missing years of Jesus from 12 to 30?
Well, that gets into a fascinating area that, you see, what happened that after I heard about the Edgar Cayce material when I was 18 years old, and I started reading and studying and getting more and more into depth with the Cayce material, and I found out about the readings, so many Cayce readings, which told that young Jesus had lived for many years in India and studied there and traveled and healed and so on. And what happened about the thing that threw me for a loop, you see, I wanted to go in the Peace Corps to go to India, and they didn't offer that. In other words, at the time, they needed some water well drillers for the Peace Corps to go to India, about 30 of them, and I didn't qualify for that. But the Peace Corps people said, well, we can get you close to India. We can get you to Afghanistan, and like about half the people in the Peace Corps at any given time will train you to teach English as a second language, ESL. I didn't know anything about Afghanistan at the time, but I thought, well, it's close to India, and all you have to do is just cross Pakistan. Pakistan is a wonderful country also. But anyway, you can go overland, for example, from Kabul in Afghanistan. You can. There's a local bus there that goes through the Khyber Pass over to Pakistan called the Silver Bullet. But anyway, what happened was that in the first chapter of my book, it ties in with this. It's called A Very Strange Bottle of Beer, A Connection with Jesus in India. And to briefly tell you what happened was that during the time that I was in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan, there were some rough days sometimes. And yeah, rough days and so on like that. And you get spit on, things happen, and so on. Anyway, that after work one day, I went over to the American Embassy Annex, which at that time, they had there was in the American Embassy Annex, there was a bar for expatriates, that is for expatriates meaning people out of their country, Americans and others. And what happened was that there was a Pakistani Christian bartender there named Mr. Wilson. And Mr., in other words, a Pakistani
Christian. Wait a minute, a Pakistani bartender by the name of Mr. Wilson?
Because he was a Pakistani Christian. You see, when Pakistanis become Christians, they require that they take a Christian name, Western-sounding name. So he was the Pakistani Christian bartender. So I was there after work that time, and I noticed a bottle of beer that, among others, behind the counter that said Murray Beer, M-U-R-R-E-E. And so I said, it was a quiet time, and so I said to Mr. Wilson, I said, that beer, Murray Beer, I said, is that named after, it's brewed in Pakistan, right? And he said, oh, yes, brewed near Rawalpindi. At Murray. And I said, oh, it's brewed there. I said, is it named after, it must be named after an Englishman. He said, no, sir, it is named after Mary. I said, oh, Mary. Oh, Mary must be an English woman. He said, no, sir, Mary is mother of Jesus. And I said, there's a Pakistani beer that's named after the mother of Jesus? And he said, most assuredly, that's right. And I said, why would a Pakistani beer be named after Mary, the mother of Jesus? And he said, because her tomb is in that place. She is buried in that place, Murray, in northern Pakistan, about 40 miles from Rawalpindi, in Himalayan foothills. There's tomb of Mary. And I said, whoa.
Oh, exactly.
You're saying that Mary, the mother of Jesus Christ, is buried in northern Pakistan in the Himalayan foothills? Most assuredly, sir, that is absolutely correct. I've been there, holy place of pilgrimage, the last 2,000 years. And I said, how could that possibly be? And he briefly told me something to the effect that some people believe Jesus did not die on cross. He returned after recuperating, returned to India. And his mother insisted on going with him. And she became sick and died and is buried in that place. And then he explained that the tomb, it faces in the Jewish fashion east and west, and the Muslim tombs point north and south. And he explained that, this was something I found out later, that the Muslims, the knowledgeable Muslims, have a high regard for Jesus, and in the Holy Quran, that Jesus is referred to as, he's one of the major prophets in the Holy Quran. He's referred to as Hazrat Isa, Prophet Jesus, and of course his mother is considered an important figure. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, about the Holy Quran, that there are only two women mentioned by name in the Quran. One is Khadijah, the wife of the Prophet Muhammad, and the other is Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Well, now, did these travels occur in this missing period?
What happened, and I wasn't looking for it, and I didn't want to find it, was that there was information here coming up that Jesus had survived the crucifixion and returned to India, where he had spent his youth, and that along the way that his mother Mary died, and it was her time to pass on, and that she's buried there in northern Pakistan. And so that really threw me for a loop, and I thought, well, I'm going to go to India to investigate about the teenage years and early 20s, those missing years of Jesus anyway. And I thought, if I can find out anything else about that, as far-fetched as it sounds, I thought, if I can find out something, I'll see what I can find. And then the next thing I found in Kashmir, in Srinagar, really blew me away.
Well, wait a minute, though. I got to ask you about this. How could he have survived the crucifixion?
That gets into an interesting area, which is basically that the legs were not broken, and that I've talked at length with two medical doctors about crucifixion. I include a lot about this in my book, but that about crucifixion, if the legs are not, the way the quick way for crucifixion to work to kill someone is that the legs are broken, and then the individual cannot push himself or herself up on the cross to keep breathing, and the person dies of a nitrogen narcosis. It's a buildup of nitrogen in the lungs because right. The individual cannot breathe properly. And for a young, healthy person like Jesus was at the time, and to not have the legs broken, that it was for him to die within a three-hour time span, it was very surprising, and it was surprising to Pontius Pilate. The other aspect of it was that the spear wound to the side, that there are many indications, including in the Talmud of Emmanuel, that the spear wound was only a superficial cut to the hip area, the loin area, and this gets into a really interesting area, that the centurion in charge of the crucifixion, there is a lot of material about him, that legends and folklore material, that his name was Caius Longinus, and that Longinus was a sympathizer of Jesus, and that Longinus was good with languages, and the Romans often sent him in mufti, in disguise, to go and spy on Jesus, and so British soldiers were sent in disguise to go listen to Gandhi. And they got to a point where the British soldiers were told, don't get close enough we send you a spy on Gandhi, don't get close enough so you can listen to him if he's talking in English.
Well, but why do these stories, Edward, differ from what the apostles wrote?
That gets into the interesting area about the origins of the New Testament Gospels. Basically, that the earliest of the New Testament Gospels came to public knowledge around 105 A.D., and that as Bishop Papias of the early Christian Church explained and wrote about, the source document was a document called the Logia. And the Logia, Bishop Papias wrote four treatises on it, which were, he said that the Logia document was full of heresies, and that each of the translators dealt with the heresies as best they could. So, to put it briefly, a great amount of information has been held back from us on purpose.
What does Christianity say about this theory?
About the survival of the crucifixion?
Yes.
Well, you see, what happened was that resurrection won out in the early Christian church, and most notably to someone of a very violent nature, Saul of Tarsus, who became known as Paul, the Apostle Paul.
Right.
And, of course, you know about the conversion on the road to Damascus, about 10 miles or so south of Damascus. And I can tell you about that in the Talmud of Emmanuel and so on. But that Christianity, you see, Paul put the Pharisee spin on early Christianity, basically changing Christianity into a Paulinism. In other words, the Pharisees believed in the resurrection of dead bodies, that at the Day of Judgment, that the dead bodies, the bones, would take on flesh and rise out of the graves, and there'd be that great resurrection of the dead bodies. And the events that happened at the time of the crucifixion, I can tell you more details about the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea that it had.
Let me ask you this, though. They take Jesus down from the cross, right?
Right, Joseph of Arimathea.
Are you saying everybody at the moment thought he was dead?
Everybody except Joseph of Arimathea. And Joseph of Arimathea, who could very probably see auras, could see that he was in a state of near death. He was close to death, very close to death, but he was in a state of near death, as he prophesied that he would be in a state of near death, and that's in the Talmud of Emmanuel, and we'll talk about it more. He was in a state of near death. Joseph of Arimathea could see that he was not quite dead, and Joseph of Arimathea quickly ran to his friend Pontius Pilate, got permission to take the body down. Pontius Pilate expressed amazement that a young, healthy man in good shape without broken legs, with just a superficial cut in the hip, would be dead that quickly from crucifixion.
Yeah, but did Pilate think he was dead?
Pilate accepted what he was told. He was told, the Roman centurion, we get back to Cassius Longinus, the sympathizer, who made the superficial cut in the hip was like a primitive test of jabbing a needle in a person's arm to see if there's a flinch, if they're dead. If they're
right.
Not dead, they'll flinch. If you jab the needle and there's no motion, then a primitive test, an old test, was that no flinch from the needle, they're dead. and no noticeable breath and so on. Well, they couldn't test his breath very easily, but the centurion made the announcement after the superficial cut in the hip, and out came what looked like water mixed with blood, that is the clear lymph with the blood, as in the case of someone who's dead or near dead. And the centurion said, "He's dead. Let's go home." And of course, the horrible storm was coming, the rain was coming, and none of the Roman soldiers were going to argue with the centurion and let's go back to the barracks, get out of the rain. And the others were weeping, but Joseph of Arimathea could see that he was not dead.
Do you believe that there was anything supernatural about any of this?
Oh, goodness, yes. It gets to an area of what we describe as supernatural. One of the things that happened right after that, that the Talmud of Emmanuel describes about, is that one of the Pleiadian commanders came and landed in a beam ship in front or near the front part of the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. He stepped out, and he was his raiment was shining and glowing, and the Roman soldiers were just aghast and dumbfounded, and this Pleiadian commander stretched his arms out, pointed them, and out came lightning bolts. It's like some of the shows that you see in Las Vegas. Incidentally, that Mark Bean, by the way, is a great scientist who does some of those lightning bolt shows in Las Vegas. So I don't rule out that those lightning bolts from the Pleiadian commander, they could have been just by normal technology, or they could have been by spiritual means.
Mm. Well, you know, the Bible does write about strange craft in the sky.
You bet. Going back to Ezekiel, Elijah, fiery chariots, the wheels of Ezekiel, many, many things in the Old Testament and the New Testament, including the Star of Bethlehem, which was shining down, the hovering and shining down the light with a long tail at the stable.
Well, now, did they put the live body of what some people thought was dead of Christ in the tomb, wrapped up in what could have been the Shroud of Turin?
Yes, that the Talmud of Emmanuel explains how that Joseph of Arimathea, the secret of the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, which was custom made, possibly by Egyptian stonecutters, a team, but the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea had a back tunnel entrance. It had the two entrances, and there's even been a tomb found recently that has a back tunnel entrance. But it had a back tunnel entrance, and so the big stone was rolled in front. Joseph of Arimathea, it says in the Talmud of Emmanuel that a linen cloth was already prepared, which had an image of Emmanuel painted into it. The body was wrapped in that, quickly taken, put in the tomb. The big stone was rolled in the front. The Roman guards were set in place. And then Joseph of Arimathea quickly ran to get the healers, Emmanuel's friends from India, and there were perhaps two or three of them. And they knew the prophecy that Emmanuel had made, that he would rise, he would leave the tomb after 3 days and nights, recover from near death. And they had medicines, bandages. One of the medicines is a famous one you can still get in the Middle East called Matami Isa, the ointment of Jesus. They had food, medicine, water, bandages, lanterns. And they ministered to him for 3 days and nights in the tomb. They went in through that back tunnel entrance, which could not be seen from the front. And then after 3 days and three nights, that he was well enough to get up and stand and move around. And they, early in the morning, on the third, after 3 days and three nights, as he prophesied, it would be the sign of Jonah, that as Jonah went into the great fish, the whale, for 3 days and nights and emerged alive, he said, Emmanuel said that he would emerge alive from the tomb. And that, so they went out through the back tunnel entrance. The appearances took place after that, for example, at the site of the Last Supper. And, of course, we know about Doubting Thomas had to touch the wounds, and he touched them. And then the other appearances took place, for example, such as by the Sea of Galilee with the big catch of fish. And Emmanuel had his face covered, and he said, "Throughout they had not caught any fish all night." And he said, "Throw out your nets on the right side." They did. And they pulled in so many fish they couldn't pull it in. And then
what do you say to people, Edward, who believe in the biblical version of this, and they hear this about Billy Meyer and those from outer space tied into Jesus, and the fact that your thoughts are that he did not die, did not resurrect? I mean, they must come at you from both ends, huh?
Oh, sure. I can understand. And it took me about, from when I first heard about the survival of the crucifixion, I just put up a wall against that, and I said, no, he was dead. He was stoned. That's what the New Testament says. And it was only later with my research that I found out, to my shock and amazement, that the New Testament has been profoundly altered. For example, the book of Matthew, in more than 200 places, altered, censored, redacted things have been taken out and put in. And there are many indications also that the real betrayer was not Judas Iscariot, but was someone else with a similar name, Judah Iscariot, the son of Simeon, one of the high priests. And I can tell you information and evidence about that.
Okay, yeah, I want to know that, because you're going to have to sell me on this one.
Oh, sure, I understand, and it should be that way. For example, about the Talmud of Emmanuel document, my good friend Dr. Jim Deardorff of Corvallis, Oregon, he's been researching it now. He's a wonderful scholar and a retired professor, and he set out at first to scholarly do this wonderful scholarly research and to disprove it. And he, after 16 years, that he has come to exactly the opposite conclusion in the authenticity and truth of the Talmud of Emmanuel document, which basically is the original Gospel of Matthew before it got altered and redacted.
You do believe, though, that this spirit that was Jesus, or in Jesus, was truly something of a magnificent nature?
Exactly. Most profoundly. And that the some of the key points of difference, one, is that he was teaching reincarnation, not resurrection of dead bodies. He was teaching, just as the Casey material came out. Casey did not believe in reincarnation at first, and it was only through the readings that, and I can tell you more details about that, specifically the reading with Arthur Lammers.
All right, well, you hold that thought, because
sure,
there's more profound statements just ahead. I'm George Norrie. My guest is Edward T. Martin. You've heard some of the things he said. We'll find out a little bit more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Edward Martin, my guest. Edward, your take on another theory that the tomb of Jesus is in Japan.
Yes, my understanding about the Takeuchi document, that it is an ancient document, but as you say, it's a document that's not open to the public. There is a mound, a burial place, which I have heard and read about. To put it briefly, from the research of my friend Dr. Jim Deardorff, the evidence about a tomb of Jesus in Japan, it's really sketchy. It's really shaky about that, and there's not much corroborating evidence. What I do think is certainly possible concerning that is that in the years after the crucifixion, when Emmanuel, when Jesus had returned to India, and then he went to Srinagar in Kashmir at about the age of 45, that he got married to a pretty young lady known as Marianne, and they had several children, and then he later lived to about the age of 110 and is buried in that area of Srinagar. There's the public access tomb, which I've been to in Srinagar. Concerning about the tomb of Jesus in Japan that you mentioned, that my understanding is that he may very well have traveled to Japan, and for example, that his brother who returned to India, Judas Thomas, who is also called Didymus in Greek, the twin, because he looked a lot like Jesus, but that Jesus may very well have visited Japan and preached in Japan, and then later after he left, that some of his followers, that someone died and was buried there, and then as things got confused with time, that it was referred to as the tomb of Jesus himself.
What do you think he looked like, Edward?
Oh, yes. Just to give you a brief description, that that he was around 6 feet, around 6 foot one, that he was a good-looking gentleman. His hair was reddish-brown hair. His eyes were grayish-blue, and that he had a neat reddish beard and mustache, that he was a robust figure. In fact, I base this on several things that, in connection with the Casey material, there is a document by a Roman who witnessed Jesus, that is, who attended some of his talks and gave it a physical description, which coincides with this. I tell about this in my book. And then another source of this information is that that Aziz Kashmiri, a newspaper editor I met and interviewed at length in Kashmir, India, he saw an actual portrait of Jesus at the Himiskompa Monastery at Leh in northwestern India, and he saw that portrait in 1965 at the Himiskompa Monastery, and that coincided with this. It was a portrait. There were in the archives, the lower sections of the monastery, there were dozens, I should say hundreds, of portraits, most of which were of Buddhist priests and monks and abbots who were shaved-headed and were wearing the orange, maroon, the saffron robes like the Dalai Lama mm-hmm. would wear. But there's one that's very different of a man who had a full head of hair and beard and a mustache, and he was wearing a warm woolen cap like they still wear in Afghanistan, a design which, by the way, comes from Alexander the Great's army in 300 B.C., they love those woolen caps, and they still make them. But anyway, that Aziz Kashmiri, the newspaper editor, that he asked the Lama, the priest who was showing them around, he said, "Who is this one?" And the Lama leaned over, and they're shining the flashlights, and they removed the dust from the bottom of the portrait, and he was sounding it out. The writing was in an ancient form of Tibetan script called Pali, and it said something to the effect, traveling Hebrew sage and holy man, something like Yeshush or Yeshua, who was here in the time of the abbot, so-and-so, and he said that was about 2,000 years ago. And that, incidentally, that coincides with the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ by Levi Dowling. That
so do you think he looks like the picture that's on the Shroud of Turin?
Somewhat. But not exactly. I think he looks somewhat like that. And my understanding is that the image on the Shroud of Turin was perhaps painted on, incidentally, that perhaps you know about some of the research about the
Shroud. Well, I know a lot. Sure, I know a lot about a lot. I don't think it was painted on.
Well, anyway, what I mean is, I think that the Shroud of Turin may very well be genuine, and that, for example, the pollens, there's 50-some-odd or more pollens from plants that, such as the marami and these other plants that are indigenous to Israel of 2,000 years ago.
Right.
I think there are a lot of indicators that I've got a marvelous book that was sent to me here called Unlocking the Secrets of the Shroud by Gilbert R. Lavoie, L-A-V-O-I-E, and that's a marvelous book. I would not dismiss the Shroud of Turin.
Now, what I find fascinating with your theories and other thoughts of this is there seems to be no question that this person named Jesus traveled all over the place.
That's correct. That he traveled to India, that he traveled across what's the most famous trade route in the world called the Silk Road. The Silk Road is basically the same route that Marco Polo and his father and uncle took in the 1200s. The Silk Road is still an important trade route today, basically going from the modern designation for the Silk Road is United Nations Highway 1, which was the designation from about 1947. It basically goes across from the area of, you can get on it in either Israel or up in Turkey, and then it goes across through modern-day Iran, through Afghanistan, on across through, for example, there's about 300 passes across between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The most famous, of course, is the Khyber Pass. And then the Silk Road That's basically the same route that in 300 BC that Alexander the Great and his 50,000 Macedonians took when they went into India.
Well, he travels around and he's going to all these areas between these ages, these missing ages. Why does he come back?
Well, that Israel at that time, 2,000 years ago, as I understand it, was an important, very important crossroads of the world. And that it was a place where a tremendous amount of knowledge and information could be disseminated, and it would get spread by the crossroads. Of course, at that time, it was part of the Roman Empire. And that his mission was such that that he was to give those teachings, those creational teachings, there at that pivotal crossroads at that time. And, of course, that Emmanuel had the knowledge that when you tell the truth, that a lot of people hate the messenger of the truth, just like Emmanuel told about how that the historically the people of Israel murdered the prophets. Prophets would tell the truth and they'd get killed.
That's why when we open up the phone lines, people are going to attack you for this.
Oh, sure. I hope not, but yes.
We will find out. Edward, why in the Bible does it not cover the missing 18 years from 12 to 30?
To briefly explain that, you see, in the early Christian church around 100, 105 AD, the beginning of Christianity as a formalized religion, the teachings in the Logia, the Talmud of Emmanuel, which told about how that young Jesus had studied in India for many years and had literally sat at the feet of great gurus and teachers of both Hinduism and Buddhism, that this was considered in the early Christian church as anathema. In other words, let's say you're going to make a documentary film about pizza, and let's say that you're claiming that your pizza is the best pizza in the world, and we're making this wonderful documentary film about your pizza and the greatness of pizza, and it's lunchtime and we're still filming, and you say, I don't like pizza, let's go have hamburgers. Or you say also, oh, by the way, let's also get some fried chicken, like that. And then making the documentary, of course, you'd say, oh, no, you're Mr. Super Pizza, and you're the founder of this huge pizza empire, and when we show you at lunch, we need to show you eating pizza and not eating hamburgers or fried chicken or something else. And in the same way, the founder, the head of Christianity, Jesus, that the early church fathers felt that if they showed Jesus as having studied and shown respect for other religions, such as Hinduism and Buddhism, that they felt that that wouldn't look right. They felt that that would be compromising, and they just didn't want that in there.
Hmm.
Do you see the point?
Yes, I do, on that point. I do. Now, with this, and then you've got the Billy Meyer connection.
Sure.
That's what I find hard to swallow, and I want you to tell me a little bit more about that.
Oh, sure. I was not looking for the Billy Meyer connection at all, but what happened was that when I went up to Kashmir and went to Srinagar, and I walked into a local bookstore, and I found this marvelous book there at the front part of the bookstore, Christ in Kashmir, by a local newspaper editor, Aziz Kashmiri, and it was telling about Christ in Kashmir. Well, I met and interviewed Aziz Kashmiri at length, and we had wonderful discussions. The thing that I was not expecting was that when I later was researching about the Billy Meyer case, the Talmud of Emmanuel document was told how that the Pleiadians were telling Billy Meyer that, I can give you the quote right here.
Yeah, explain that manual for me.
Sure. The quote that Semyase, who was Billy Meyer's teacher from 1975 to about 1986, Semyase said, "We know that you are aware of a secret old scripture whose originals were unfortunately destroyed. Diffuse and spread the translation of this scripture because it is the only one which is authentic truth. To us it seems to be the most important book written, but it will be harsh in language and will meet with hate. It only offers the truth to earth humans, though some speculations are in it. But it is finally able to destroy for many the madness of religion, or at least to temper it very deliberately. It is an extraordinary work, and you ought to make it accessible for human beings." And that she is talking about the Talmud of Emmanuel document, which, incidentally, if your readers are interested, if your listeners are interested, I'll give you the website of the best website about the Talmud of Emmanuel and all the related documents concerning the Billy Meyer case, which is my friend Dr. Jim Deardorff's website, which is tjresearch.info. That's T as in Tom and J as in Joseph, research, R-E-S-E-A-R-C-H, dot info, I-N-F-O. So tjresearch.info is the website of Dr. Jim Deardorff, who's been very researching this Talmud of Emmanuel document the last 16 years in tremendous detail and with great integrity and great courage. And also, so you can see, your listeners can look at that on the internet and see all of the material and the evidence and so on. The Dr. Deardorff, I should just mention also that the Tomb of Jesus website, that it's a website which is a wonderful website. The Tomb of Jesus website, specifically the webmaster of that, is Abu Bakr bin Ismail Salahuddin, who is a Muslim researcher, who has a black gentleman who has done a wonderful job, the Tomb of Jesus website. So that's tombofjesus.com. And the Tomb of Jesus website has many connecting links, a lot of color pictures, a lot of information, maps, and so on. TJResearch.info website of Dr. Jim Deardorff also has literally dozens of wonderful connecting links and about UFO-related and other materials. But I found out that the Billy Meier case, that the Billy Meier was disseminating and helping people to become aware of the Talmud of Emmanuel document and its importance. So when I got a hold of a copy of it back in the latter 1980s, I was really astounded as I was reading the Talmud of Emmanuel document. The clarity, the beauty, the sense of it, and all of the questions that it answered. I then found out about a marvelous book by Dr. Jim Deardorff called Celestial Teachings. And incidentally, Celestial Teachings is now being reprinted and will soon be available again from Granite Publishing.
What's that all about?
Granite, the Celestial Teachings is a verse-by-verse analysis, a very scholarly analysis, which is a verse-by-verse comparison between the verses in the Talmud of Emmanuel document and the Gospel of Matthew. It's a verse-by-verse comparison, very scholarly, and has there are many New Testament scholars which are expressing their concerns about. They can tell that the Gospel of Matthew, which we have in the New Testament, they can tell it's been altered. They can tell it's been messed with. It's been redacted, censored, altered. And there are so many things that they know have been altered. And the New Testament scholars don't know what the logia was, what the original document was that it came from, that contained so many heresies.
Well, see, I was raised a Catholic. I believe in a lot of things that I've read about and that I've been taught. I'm having a difficult time, and I can easily believe that he traveled all over the place, but what I just have a difficult time believing that he physically survived all that.
You have my sympathy growing up as a Catholic. Like Our Lady of Eternal Guilt and so on. But
Wait. You're not knocking the Catholic religion, are you?
I'm saying that there are many. I've been a Catholic priest in a couple of past lifetimes, and I have a lot of respect for Catholicism. I'm sorry for some of the bad aspects. Disempowering and putting guilt trips on people and so on.
Well, and there are in probably every religion.
Oh, yes. That's how religions have been perverted, sadly enough, to disempower people. And the Talmud of Emmanuel is about empowering people, just as Emmanuel was teaching, to help people to get in touch with their eternal spirit, their eternal human soul, which is omnipotent, as the Talmud of Emmanuel explains. But to answer your question that concerning, you were asking about Catholicism, and then, go ahead.
Well, I was saying that I am having a difficult time being convinced that Jesus did not die on the cross, and whether he resurrected or not, one doesn't know. One needs to believe that. I'm a little confused that there are no reports of his survival in the Bible.
They're not supposed to be in the Bible. They were basically taken out. And there are, outside of the Bible, there are a vast number of reports. And this is mostly centered around Kashmir in northwestern India. And incidentally, that tombofjesus.com website has a huge amount of material, documents, and so on like that. The time after the crucifixion that he was referred to, the name that he used after the crucifixion was Yuz Asaf, the leader of the cleansed, like the leader of the cleansed lepers. So he was known by the name Yuz Asaf. He was he's referred to by a number of different names after that time. The Buddhists refer to him as Avalokitesvara, and Avalokitesvara was one of the avatars, one of the high enlightened beings. He's also referred as Apollonius of Tyana. He's referred to by different names and so on like that. And also some of the early church fathers, the reports got back to the area of Israel, to some of the early church fathers that he did not die on the cross, which incidentally, that's what the Holy Quran says, in contrast to the Holy Bible, the Holy Quran says that they did not kill him on the cross, and that he survived and went with his mother to a faraway land, a high land with springs and flowers, which perfectly describes Kashmir.
All right, stay with us. Lots more to come. Edward Martin, my guest. And again, if you haven't been to Ardbell's website, you might want to bop over there. It's linked right up. Keith has it all set up. Tombofjesus.com. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast.
Through the darkness and good times, I knew I'd make it. And the world thought I had it all, but I was waiting for you.
Welcome back. I'm George Norrie, Mr. Edward Martin, my guest. Edward, let me ask you this. Do you think that Jesus might have been an alien traveling here? Is that possible?
I think in the sense that as the Pleiadians were talking about the soul origin, the human soul origin of Emmanuel was from that star system called Lassen in one of the outer arms of this Milky Way galaxy. So in that sense that you could say he was an alien, and with the biology, that is the genetics, that the biological father, as we were talking about earlier, of course the mother was Mary of the Earth, but the biological father was Gabriel, one of the Pleiadian commanders, and the arrangement was by consent with Mary. And that was, as I understand, either by artificial insemination or else by spiritual means. But that
that's one wild theory, Edward.
It sounds wild, yeah, yeah. It sounds wild. That there are a lot of a lot of wild sounding things. I know. Yeah.
Ooh.
And I know it sounds wild, and it's just like for example, in the Billy Meyer case, in the material that in 1957, when during the time frame when Billy's teacher was Ascot from the Dowell universe, a human being like we are, very spiritually advanced, that with 1957, Ascot gave Billy the chance to time travel and to go back to 32 AD, and Billy got to sit down and talk with Emmanuel, with Jesus. Sit down on a rock with him at a place called Bethpage near the Garden of Gethsemane, and got to talk to him a couple of hours.
And some of the things that might have been said are the things you're relating to us right now.
Yeah, I've even got a transcript here of the translation, and basically that Emmanuel was saying things to the effect, "Many lies shall get put into my mouth." And he was saying that, in effect, that his religion, his teachings about reincarnation and karma, the law of cause and effect, and his teachings and his efforts to get people to take self-responsibility and to, through meditation and seeking and searching, to get in touch with their eternal spirit, their eternal soul, which is omnipotent. And in other words, teaching people to become empowered, and just like the teaching that Emmanuel gave, that these works, these miracles that I do, ye can do also, and greater. So,
what if Billy Martin, though, Edward, was way off base in some of the things he is talking about? What would that do to some of the things you're saying tonight?
Well, I think that people about Billy Meyer, I think people should investigate if they're interested. They can, for example, that the Billy Meyer website is FIGU. There are a couple of them easy to access. One is FIGU.org, FIGU.org, and another is BillyMeyer.com, the America website, and that's BillyMeyer.com. And just check out some of that information. Get a copy of Light Years by Gary Kinder. Find it at a used bookstore. Read Light Years. Investigate, seek, and search. And just see how the Meyer material resonates and how people feel about it. I'm at the same conclusion as Dr. Jim Dierdorf. After years and years of research, my conclusion is, without a doubt, in my case, is that it is genuine, and it's upsetting information in a lot of ways.
All right, if Christ survived the crucifixion.
Right.
There are other reports, too, in South America that a bearded gentleman who also had some incredible spirituality.
Quetzalcoatl, or also called Kukulcan.
Might we all be talking about the same person?
Exactly. That in the years after the crucifixion and after Emmanuel had returned back to India, he returned there with, it was after recuperating for a couple of years up in Damascus at a safe house, and after that couple of years that Emmanuel was informed that Saul of Tarsus and a gang of thugs would be coming up the road to Damascus, Emmanuel went to a friend who prepared fireworks and things like that, and anyway, Saul had the conversion, and from the fireworks and from Emmanuel speaking to him sharply about things. But anyway, after returning to India, that is, Emmanuel returned with his mother Mary, with his brother Judas Thomas, and also with Judas Iscariot, who was not the betrayer, and who was his lifelong friend and neighbor. And Judas Iscariot lived to about the age of 90. And it was Judas Iscariot, by the way, who wrote the Talmud of Emmanuel document.
Well, why did Judas get nailed in the Bible, then, if you say he was not the offender?
Oh, it's a simple reason, and it's explained in the Talmud of Emmanuel. Basically, the real betrayer of Emmanuel had an almost identical name, Judah Iscariot. Judah Iscariot, the real betrayer, was the son of Simeon Iscariot. Simeon was one of the powerful high priests on the Sanhedrin, one of the betrayers, incidentally, that is, one of the arresting gang that night, that horrible night at Gethsemane when Emmanuel was betrayed. So Judah Iscariot was the betrayer. And then what happened was Judah Iscariot did two crimes, by the way. The first crime was that he stole the original Talmud of Emmanuel documents from the bag of the scribe, Judas Iscariot. And then he was paid 70 pieces of silver for that, and then he was paid 30 pieces of silver for the betrayal, that is, that going up and greeting Emmanuel that night, giving him the kiss of betrayal, like they still kiss in the Middle East, the men kiss on the cheeks, and they do that.
Kiss on the cheek. Oh, they still do that too.
Yeah, kiss on the cheeks that way. Men kiss other men, like in Afghanistan and Middle East and so on. The betrayal. What happened right after the betrayal? And of course, Emmanuel pointed that out that night when Judah Iscariot, the real betrayer, the son of Simeon, gave him that kiss of betrayal. That Emmanuel said, "Why do you come to me with treason in your heart?" And then Simeon the father and the others stepped up and they arrested Emmanuel, and Emmanuel pointed out, he said that you may succeed for a long time of accusing my faithful disciple,
Judas Iscariot of this betrayal, but he said, in 2,000 years, the truth will come out and become known by all in the whole world, namely, that my betrayer is not Judas Iscariot, but is your son, Judah Iscariot, the son of Simeon.
Are you saying they got the names wrong?
No, the names were intentionally. What happened was that when Emmanuel was being tortured and the crown of thorns was rammed down on his head and so on like that, Judah Iscariot, the son of Simeon, the real betrayer, he was looking through the open door, and he was looking like the others in the crowd, and at one point, the eyes met. That is, Emmanuel, as he was being tortured, and the blood was running down his face, Emmanuel, his eyes met with Judah Iscariot, and something snapped within Judah Iscariot, and Judah Iscariot went, this gets really interesting, Judah Iscariot went to the high priest, and he threw the 30 pieces of silver down, which, incidentally, the scribe and treasurer, Judas Iscariot, often had much more than 30 pieces of silver in his treasury bag. And why would he betray? Well, he had a lot more than that often. But anyway, that Judah Iscariot threw down the 30 pieces of silver, and the Talmud of Emmanuel explains what he said, that I have done evil, I have betrayed innocent blood, and this man is a good man, and his teachings are good, I have done wrong. And they basically said, we don't care how you feel about yourself, you've already done your part. You've pointed him out, and he's turned over to us. You've done your part. We don't care how you feel. And it says that he ran away, Judah Iscariot ran away, wept bitterly, and that probably, I think certainly what happened, his father, who was standing right there, Simeon, told one of his servants, follow Judah, watch him, see that he is all right. Mm-hmm. And Judah Iscariot, he may have had a couple of stiff drinks, and then he went out to the Potter's Field area, climbed up in a tree. The man following him, I'm speculating, might have been somewhat portly or heavy, and Judah Iscariot was quickly able to climb up into the tree. The man following him was looking up, Judah, what are you doing? What are you doing in the branches? Judah Iscariot took his rope belt from around his waist, he tied one end to a branch, he tied the other end around his neck, and he jumped, and it broke his neck, killed him instantly. And, of course, the man following him was aghast. He was horrified. He rushed back to the high priest, including the father, Simeon, and he explained what had happened, that Judah Iscariot, your son, Simeon, has just killed himself, hanged himself. And then they came up right away. They said, look, all of the 12, including the scribe, Judas Iscariot, they're all in fear for their lives and all hiding. None of them dare show their face. Let us switch the names. We'll switch the names and say that it was the scribe, Judas Iscariot, who was the betrayer, who hanged himself. And then they said, excellent, that absolves Simeon's son, Judah Iscariot, from the crime. And, of course, suicide was and is a horrible crime within Judaism, within the Jewish religion. And so they said, look, this gets your son off. And we'll tell the people, if anyone asks about Simeon's son, Judah Iscariot, will say he's gone away on a foreign trip. He's gone away someplace. And the high priest said, let's have the body quickly buried, and which is in accord with the Jewish custom and also the Islamic custom, have the body quickly buried and place a guard over the grave and tell everyone that say, look, it was one of his 12 disciples, Judas Iscariot, the scribe. And of course, he handpicked all the 12. They'll say, look, one of his own people betrayed him for 30 pieces of silver, so how can his teachings be any good?
So for 2,000 years, Judas is being called a traitor, and you're saying he never was.
Exactly. He is not and was not the traitor. And the truth of this will be, as Emmanuel prophesied in the Talmud of Emmanuel, and I certainly believe Emmanuel, that he said that that truth will become known by all in the whole world, namely, that his betrayer was not his disciple, Judas Iscariot, but was Judah Iscariot, the son of Simeon, the high priest, one of the high priests. And incidentally, that I've always wondered about that. Like in Bible school, when I was raised as a fundamentalist Christian, I always said, well, why, if Jesus had all this great, profound knowledge, which he did, and I said, why would he pick a rotten apple? Do you see what I'm saying? Why would he pick a guy, one of the 12, that would betray him? Couldn't he see that?
Well, unless he did it on purpose.
No, he didn't do it on purpose. And then that gets into the other area of the allowing himself, if he were to actually die on the cross, how is that? Isn't that tantamount to committing suicide? And, of course, the Christian church wants to sidestep that and say, well, he let himself get killed. Isn't that, what's the difference between that and suicide? Do you see what I'm saying? There's so many points that are very difficult for New Testament scholars and just for ordinary people to try to understand. Another point about the night of the betrayal, they had the in our traditional gospels, there's the Last Supper, and at the Last Supper, that Judas Iscariot is saying, "Master, is it I?" And then Jesus is saying, "Verily, you have spoken. You are the one who shall betray me." And then all the other disciples, they continue eating. Now, how likely is that? These guys are fishermen and they're outdoors people and they're blunt, straightforward men. If Judas Iscariot had said right in front of them that Judas Iscariot would be the betrayor, these guys would have jumped him, tied him up, and said, "Hey, pal, you're going to have an accident in the river tonight." But that didn't happen. And we get into the witness question about some people say, "Well, they whispered that between Jesus and Judas Iscariot, that was whispered." Well, then you get into who wrote it down.
Well, there are several things in the Bible that just fascinate me, Edward, and they are two things. One is the story of Noah's Ark.
Right.
And the other is the book of Revelation and end times.
Right.
Do you believe that any of those are true?
That's interesting. I love the Noah's Ark story, and in fact, I even did some research concerning Mount Ararat at one point. There's a place in eastern Turkey called Dugabezit that's near the base of Mount Ararat.
Right.
And there's a fascinating, I even interviewed some authors some years back at Farmington, New Mexico, who wrote a wonderful book about Noah's Ark, and it's a fascinating amount of material, and there were sightings, and a great amount of history there, especially among the Armenian people, of course, who were persecuted Christians and still are in that region of eastern Turkey. But yes, there have been sightings in World War II, even World War I or World War II, from aircraft, sightings of a huge, like 450 or 500 foot long, a wooden vessel, which is, say, three levels in height, a huge wooden structure. Is on top of what's called, what's called an imbricate fault. For those who are interested, who know about geology, it's supposed to be on an imbricate fault on, I believe, the northeast face of Mount Ararat.
See, but what I'm trying to get at, Edward, is if some of those are true and that you believe it, then why aren't all of them true, all the stories true?
The sad to say, both the Old and the New Testament have been profoundly messed with. And it is through seeking and searching and studying and using our own discernment and our own knowledge and common sense and seeking and searching that I believe we can arrive at the things that are basically true and the things that have been altered.
Well, there's no question that some things may have been altered. I mean, I'm going to give you that.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's true.
The end times. Do you believe in that?
I believe that there are some terrible and traumatic events that, unfortunately, that for example, concerning World War III, things concerning in the Talmud of Emmanuel document, for example, that Emmanuel goes into some great detail. Describing about those events, saying that the human population at that time will number in excess of 5 billion human beings, and that
we're past that now, huh?
We're sure past 5 billion now, yeah. And Emmanuel was telling how that they shall build machines made out of metal, machines that will travel on the land, through the air, and on the water, and under the water, and that they shall have deadly projectiles of metal which they will fling from those machines, and they shall put the cornerstones of life into those projectiles, and that a deadly fire will scorch the earth, and describing about the oil wells being ignited, and
yes.
A climate breaking down, and all sorts of things happening.
All of those things are right out there right now.
And the fuse may be lit now concerning Iraq and concerning events that happen now or in the works as we speak, sadly.
What is Billy? Do you talk to Billy Meyer?
I've been in his house. I've been there at Kinnerschmidt-Ruti. He had a cold at the time that I was there, and I was not pressing or pushing or demanding to get to meet him. I feel that if it's the right in the future that I'll get to meet him. Just like I have a friend here in San Antonio, Texas, that who's a devotee, you could say, of Sai Baba, and she went to Sai Baba's ashram in India. She very much wanted to see Sai Baba, and Sai Baba walked within about 5 feet of her, and she was terribly downhearted, and then Sai Baba turned and smiled at her and shook his finger like, not this time, have faith, another time. And in the same way that I did not get to, when I went in around Christmas in 2000 to Switzerland and was visiting my friend Methuselah, Billy's son, and we got permission to go out there on a Thursday afternoon. Normally visitors go out on Sundays to the to Billy's place there at Hinterschmidruti. But anyway, we were out there for a couple of hours, and I got to meet other people and do other things. And I gave Billy a copy of my book and of Aziz Kashmiri's book, Christ in Kashmir. And in other words, Billy is he's a human being.
How old is he? Yeah.
He was born in 1937, and let's see, we can do the math here. He'd be...
That's got to make him about 65, I guess.
About around 65, yeah. And his birthday is February 3rd, which, incidentally, is supposed to be the same birthday as Emmanuel, February 3rd.
Go figure, right? Stay with us. My guest is Edward Martin. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Edward Martin, my guest. Edward, again, did you say the date of Jesus, the birth date, was Feb 3? What happened to the Christmas date?
You see, in the early Christian church, the that date of December 25th, that was the time of the Roman festival called the Saturnalia, and it was an important celebration time in the Roman Empire, December 25th. And it was... obscured as time had gone by about when the actual birth date of Emmanuel, of Jesus, had taken place. And also, incidentally, we know that it was in cold weather. Some of the descriptions about the shepherds and so on like that, that we know it was cold weather. The December 25th date, I think that would go to the Emperor Constantine in the early Christian church, when Constantine proclaimed Christianity as the state religion of the Roman Empire in around 300 AD. Mm-hmm. And Emperor Constantine, about that time, there's a bunch of interesting stuff, but Emperor Constantine had gone with an expedition over to the Holy Land, over to Israel, and they were searching for the actual burial tomb, the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. They were there for some months. They couldn't find it. And then what happened was that Constantine was getting in a really bad humor. You know, find the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. And then, mysteriously enough, some inscriptions were found on a tomb site there in Jerusalem. And that and then basically that was proclaimed as being the tomb site, and so that's where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built. A lot of interesting material, but the December 25th date, that there was the demand, as I understand, in the early Christian church to celebrate the birth of the Savior, the birth of Jesus, and that the December 25th date was convenient.
I'll tell you what, I've gotten a lot of emails. I thought for some reason a lot of people would think you were off base, and I'm not getting that.
You're not?
No, I'm getting some, but I'm not getting as many as I thought I would.
Wow, people are showing their good intuitive sense, and their thinking and their minds are open. My goodness, they're going to grow spiritually. My goodness.
Let's go to some of the phones. First-time caller in Houston, Texas. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
I just got a question.
All right, go for it.
I'm a spiritual person. I was born, raised, Southern Baptist. I was just wondering what our mindsets nowadays, being that we have, like, technology and all that. I believe that, you know, it messes up how things were back in the day. Like, when you look back at, you know, back in Jesus' times, you know, even before that, I mean, a way of life back in that day, this is just my opinion now, but a way of life back then, to me, you know, it's more spiritual because, you know, things, like, material-wise didn't really matter, you know? And, you know, of course it'd be more spiritual. And
well, you would think so.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they still have their ups and downs, but I mean, just, no, like, okay, with technology nowadays, you got the internet, I mean, just me talking to you. I mean, back in the day, there was no such thing, you know. I mean, try to explain back in the day what you see now.
I know, but where are you getting at here, Corey?
Pretty much, you know, the mindset. I'm just curious about their mindset back in, you know, say like the apostles or, you know, just the people that wrote the Bible. I mean, what was their mindset? You think?
That's a good question, Edward, because one of the things I've heard is that perhaps the Bible may be encrypted. It may be all code. What do you think of that?
I think that's possible, and I think that certainly at that time, 2,000 years ago, the people had a much simpler life, and my understanding from the Talmud of Emmanuel document that Emmanuel, on many occasions, he chewed out most of the 12 apostles, and basically was saying that don't you understand the parables? Don't you understand the deeper spiritual sense of what I'm trying to teach? I know he was disappointed with them at times. I know that at other times that he was profoundly pleased and gratified that, for example, the Roman centurion and the great faith that the Roman centurion had, which is it's one of those passages that in both the Talmud of Emmanuel and the Standard Gospel of Matthew that are pretty similar, that the Roman centurion discussed that his servant was sick and asked Emmanuel to heal him at a distance. And Emmanuel basically said, such faith I have not seen in Israel. I've rarely seen faith like that. And then Emmanuel said, it shall be done. He shall be healed. And then from that hour, the servant was healed. So I think that the people then, they had a much more, they had a spiritual life in the sense that they were not so bogged down with materialism as we are. And it was, I'm sure, a very hard life back then.
Well, now, if there was no resurrection, does that destroy all of Christianity and everything that they say?
No. Goodness, no. Goodness, no. That what I am saying and the truth that I understand from the Talmud of Emmanuel documents and all the research I've done, and in all humility, I'd say that people tell me I have a talent for finding the truth about things, and I would not be saying anything to you that I do not myself believe to be true. But that concerning the Talmud of Emmanuel document, that about the resurrection, to me, my Christian faith, it doesn't have any linchpins in it. In other words, that when I embraced after I found out about the Casey material, and of course, let's go just for fun. Let's play a little bit with what we do have in the standard Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Let's look at some of the passages. For example, that a man was born blind.
Now,
this didn't escape. This is in there now. A man was born blind. The disciples said unto Jesus, Master, whose fault is it that this man was born blind? Is it the parents' fault or the fault of the man himself? And do you see the underlying assumption there? The underlying assumption is that the man was born blind, could have been born blind because of some action he did in a previous lifetime. Like maybe he was a soldier and his job was gouging out prisoners' eyes or something.
Correct, right. I would believe, I believe in reincarnation myself.
Well, good. Wow, you're getting there. Great. And then another part of the, for example, that this is again in the traditional Gospels, that Jesus said unto the disciples, who do men say that I am? And then they were saying, some say that you are Elias or Elijah or one of the other prophets who has returned. And then he was saying to Simon Peter, but who do you say that I am? And he said you are the Messiah, the chosen one of God. And then right after that, the passage is there, the verse is there that says, that Jesus has said, but was it not prophesied that before my return that Elias would return? And then it says that the disciples understood that Jesus was saying, verily I say unto you, Elias has returned, and men did unto him as they would, and so they shall do unto me. And then the passage says, and then the disciples understood that he spake to them of John the Baptist. In other words, John the Baptist was the reincarnation of Elias. To me, it's in plain English there in the Gospels as we have it now. And then I would say to my Bible teachers, doesn't this just say Jesus himself was saying that Elias was reincarnated as John the Baptist? Isn't that what it's saying? And they say, well, that's not what it means. And I say, well, what does it mean? And you see what I'm saying? Or that, or other passages, for example, that take the passage about Job in the Old Testament, where the Job says, naked was I born, and naked shall I return to my mother's womb thither.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You see what I'm getting at?
So you believe that Jesus believed also in reincarnation?
Absolutely, and that he was teaching that, and that there are some passages. The Talmud of Emmanuel is very clear and very beautiful in the descriptions and the passages about the teaching of reincarnation, the teaching of karma, the law of cause and effect. Be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. Simple law of karma, cause and effect, that works itself out not only within one lifetime, but over many lifetimes, just like the Edgar Casey readings told about.
Let's go to Indianapolis, Indiana. Wildcard caller, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
One lifetime, but over many lifetimes.
So turn down your radio.
Indiana, wild.
He's gone. Let's go west of the Rockies in Oregon. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George.
Good morning to you.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure thing.
I am one of the older ones. I had a contact in 1943.
Wonderful.
I also have talked to James Deardorff, and I have the Book of Book of Emmanuel, and I really have enjoyed it.
You're a wise man.
I agree with your guest there, Mr. Martin, very much.
Wow.
And I haven't had the chance to totally do the research that he has, as I am totally blind. And I would like very much to get Mr. Martin, your email address, so a friend of mine can contact you, as I have specific reasons off the air that I would like to discuss with you.
Your eyes may be blind, but I think you're seeing more than a lot of us.
Well, that's what I was told in June by a remote viewer, said that I see more by remote view than I realize. I had a very early age, to show you an example, when I was about 8-9 years old, when I had my sighting of an ET. I had discovered in my own mind that it was a starship that guided the
the three wise men?
Well, three wise men to Bethlehem. I was taking to school. I was a farm boy. I was taking to school a bundle of hay to use in the crib.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the folks, I said, lambs weren't born in December. They were born in February and March.
Ah.
And none of these things that a very small boy made much sense to me the way they were teaching in Bible school.
Mm.
And so I think there's just been a word or two left out here and there to bring forth the facts. Like I say, I was raised a farm boy. I've lost my sight, had to leave the farm, but I have an extensive website, which I know George won't let me give out.
Oh,
I
can't
do
that.
Give me your email address, sir.
Why
yes, my email address is Jonah Publishing.
Jonah Publishing.
That's J-O-N-A-H, and then Publishing.
J-O-N-A-H.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And then Publishing, and then after the word Publishing, the number 23 at hotmail.com.
At hotmail.com.
Right. So it's,
thank you very much. I have enjoyed. I didn't get the first part. I was doing a little snoozing. I have a program every week myself, and I want to contact you to join me. I'm trying to open the door on the secrecy on very many things. I'm being a farmer. I'm trying to investigate the crop circles. We have three of them recently. One here in the state of Oregon at Forest Grove, and two in Idaho.
Marvelous. A close friend of mine, Barbara Lamb, who is one of the leading experts on crop circles, has written a marvelous book called Crop Circles Revealed. And Barbara Lamb wrote that with Judith Moore. It's a marvelous book. But thank you so much.
All right. I'm going to ask you, while I've got you on crop circles, what's your take on all those?
I believe that the majority of the crop circles are extraterrestrially created. That is, they are created, in my opinion, by extraterrestrial beings, extraterrestrial intelligence. They are marvelous, and they are part of what is called the leaky embargo. The leaky embargo, in other words, is letting us as a planetary situation gradually come to the awareness that we are not the only intelligent beings in the universe. The leaky embargo is letting us gradually know, and of course, tied in with all this is what's called plausible deniability. That any of this stuff, including all the things about the Billy Meier case and all the vast millions of UFO sightings that skeptics and people who are not ready to believe it, they can plausibly deny it, and that's well and good, because no one should be convinced of anything against their free will. There is a profound and marvelous spiritual mystery about free will. It's very important.
I've seen some of the film video from Billy Meier, and it is incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, one little thing that a sequence, for example, in some of the movie sequence about there's a hovering beam ship, one of the saucer craft, which is moving around a top of a fir tree, and at one point in the backwash, that the tip of the fir tree sways. And I've heard some people, I won't say their name, but some so-called UFO experts have said, well, that looks too choppy, the movement. And the Pleiadians pointed out that they don't normally move their beam ships, for example, around a tree in that choppy a manner, but they did that for plausible deniability. You see what I'm getting at? In other words, that the Pleiadians and others do certain things to put in an element like an escape valve, kind of like skeptics who don't want to believe it, here's something that's a reason for disbelief.
What do you believe the Pleiadians look like?
Oh, that they look basically like us, that they're good-looking people, Homo sapiens, human beings like we are, they live, their genetics have not been altered. Our genetics, this is another intriguing story, our genetics have been altered, but their genetics have not. They live 700 to 1,000 years, whereas we live about 70 to 100 years. And also that our genetics have been altered in the sense that normal self-defense, which is part of the creational laws, normal self-defense, like all creatures in nature, including rabbits, a rabbit will fight for her young and so on, that the normal self-defense within human beings has been altered in ancient times to make us more warlike, hotter-tempered, more volatile, more warlike, more ready to fight than is normal human nature. And so in other words, we Earth humans, our genetics, and I can tell about this in more detail, and I tell about it in my book, but a sad thing is that our genetics were altered to give us these short lifetimes, 700 to 1,000 years, and to make us more warlike than is normal human nature.
Well, we are warlike. Who altered our genetics?
That goes back a number of thousands of years back to the region of Sirius, the dog star, S-I-R-I-U-S, that going back before that, in very ancient times, I can tell you how ancient, the region of Lyra, the harp, and Vega, the region of Lyra, constellation Lyra, and the star Vega, there was a great warfare, which was actually about 22 million years ago, according to the Pleiadians. They were blowing up planets, just like in Star Wars. There were two factions in the great spacer ships that fled the insanity going on 22 million years ago. And the one faction, they went to the region of what is now the Pleiades. The other faction went to the region of the constellation of Sirius, the dog. And that faction, some thousands of years ago, that faction in the region of Sirius, the dog star, this is in the contact notes, Billy Meyer's contact notes from the Pleiadians, that the group in the region of Sirius, those humans, they decided to create a mercenary class of human beings who, and at like professional mercenaries, and they had done their, just like we did a few years ago, they did their human genome project with the technology of computers and so on, and the Pleiadians say that all human cultures, all human civilizations, and they say there's 500 million plus planets with human beings like we are just here in the Milky Way galaxy, not to mention the other galaxies. But anyway, they did their human genome project. They decided to alter the genetics and create a mercenary class. So one was that they altered the genetics to take the self-defense aspect, make them more warlike, more hot-tempered, ready to fight. It's just like the beginning of World War II when the bombing of Pearl Harbor took place. I'm told by people that so many American men volunteered to kill Japanese, that they ran out of uniforms for a few months.
Tell you what, Edward, somebody made us mean. No doubt about that. The human being, that's all it does is fight. We'll be back with more of your questions, comments. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Edward, if you could go back into time and you talked to Jesus, what one thing would you ask him?
That is a profoundly good question. And I would say that from my research, I cannot think of much that I would ask him. I would perhaps ask him that what kind of profound disappointment that he feels about the direction that the Christian churches have gone in, about mm-hmm. laying guilt trips on people and disempowering people, and how that he feels about that. From reading that conversation with Billy, that I have a good sense of the sadness that he would feel about that, that he knows very well that Christianity, both Catholicism and Protestantism have been perverted to a great extent into cult organizations, and the leadership, many of the leaders of which, as you realize, are their hearts are far from him, and they're interested in the chattels and goods and controlling the people and disempowering the people. I don't know, I might ask Jesus about would he? I know he had a good sense of humor. I might ask him if he were to visit our time, if he would enjoy going to Hooters, or ask him, about the crucifixion. That according to the Casey material, that on the way to the crucifixion, that Jesus was laughing and expressing humor on the way to the crucifixion, and I've come across that from some other accounts too.
Laughing.
Correct. Laughing, he loved jokes and humor, and on the way to the crucifixion, of course, he was horribly suffering and bleeding and so on like that, and had the crown of thorns on, but that he was saying some humorous things, so the Casey readings say that, and I believe have great faith in the Casey readings, and also Harmon Breaux, who was one of the significant people in the Edgar Casey movement there at Virginia Beach. Harmon Breaux made a statement. He said, it takes a hell of a man to laugh with splinters in his butt. So
yeah, I would think so.
I would think so. Yes, I would just, I've had dreams to mention something briefly, that just a year ago in the summertime that I had a wonderful meeting with Dr. Leo Sprinkle up in Laramie, Wyoming. Leo is one of the leaders in the UFO field concerning hypnosis about
yes.
UFO missing time and so on
yes,
like that
yes.
and reincarnation things. And I had known Leo about 10 years, and mentioned that because I asked Leo about a year ago in the summer when I was up there the last time at Laramie, I said, Leo, would you go into the self-trance, and in the self-trance, which is like Edgar Casey, I said, would you go into the self-trance and tell me if 2,000 years ago, in any capacity, did I ever meet Emmanuel, that is Jesus, or know him, have any dealings with him, eye contact, anything? And he went into the trance, and he told me, he said, 2,000 years ago, that I was a young Hindu priest in northern India, and that I was a devout Hindu priest, and that I was physically fit, and that one of my jobs that I was given, I was asked to be a guide for a young Hebrew visitor, and the young Hebrew visitor needed to go to various monasteries in remote areas in the Himalayas there in northern India, and I was the guide, and I'm sure that we had many wonderful conversations over days and days as we were walking, and that individual, Emmanuel, had a profound effect on my life, and that there's something that resonated in me that in this lifetime that I took fundamentalist Christianity very seriously growing up as a fundamentalist, and I just really wanted to go with the ball game, and yet so many things didn't make sense. Like when I'd ask, what happened during the missing years between the ages of 12 and 30? And there's only the one transitional verse in Luke, and Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and men. And then, boom, he's 30 years old, being baptized by John the Baptist at the River Jordan. John the Baptist, who was perhaps his cousin. And I would ask my Bible teachers, I'd say, well, why didn't he start his ministry sooner? What was he doing? Was he making tables and chairs for that 18 years? And they'd say, well, why do you ask such strange questions? And I'd say, I don't think it's strange to ask that 18 years missing, and he's the most important figure in Western civilization, and we love him, and I love Jesus, love Emmanuel, and why can't we find out about the missing 18 years? Or for example, the movie Ben-Hur, that they show Jesus not in the carpentry shop, and the man says, why isn't my table finished? And then it shows Jesus, he's off walking in the hills, and there's classical music playing, and he's magically,
right, yeah.
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Let's go to some calls. First-time caller. Let's go to you in Watsonville, California. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi, George. I've written about 5 pages of information.
Okay.
And I think it's really great. And I would like to ask Edward a couple questions.
Okay, fire away.
Go ahead.
How long have you been gathering all this information?
Oh, over 20 years now.
Yeah, so, you know, I pretty much believe you, okay?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah,
you're a wise lady.
I have had doubts. I was raised Catholic, but I've had doubts about, you know, how they conduct their business, and there's got to be another explanation.
Exactly.
And about Edgar Casey, so I'd like to know about your book. What is the name of your book?
It's called King of Travelers. King of Travelers, Jesus Lost Years in India. And called King of Travelers, Jesus Lost Years in India. I'll tell you where the title comes from in just a moment. But incidentally, for people who are interested, a website that a friend and I, a website where the book can be ordered with a credit card, if anyone's interested, it's mindbodyspiritonline.com.
Okay, mindbody.
Is it on Amazon.com at all?
They have a limited supply.
Mm-hmm. Mind, body, spirit, and it's the words online.
Correct. In other words, the words mind, body, spirit, and then O-N-L-I-N-E com.
So is that your website, or
my friend and I, the website, and there are, you see the cover of my book, you'll see the back cover, you'll see passages like the first chapter and other photos, and the book has 62 photos and 2 maps and a set of drawings. The cover photo is photo.
What are the photos of? What do they show?
Places in India, places in the Himalayas. I took all the photos. And the places in Afghanistan. Cover photo is near Mount Everest. It was a 21-day walk I went on in Nepal to the base camp of Mount Everest, up at about 18,200 feet.
Wow.
And so it's sunrise in the Himalayas. And
oh my God!
Yeah, so the mindbodyspiritonline.com.
So what about we can contact you that way, or do you give out a phone number also, or not?
Let me give you my email, which is Jonah Publishing. That's J-O-N-A-H, and then the word publishing, and the number 23@hotmail.com. So Jonah Publishing 23@hotmail.com. 23 is one of my lucky numbers. So Jonah Publishing 23@hotmail.com. You can reach me that way.
How did you end up with 23 as a lucky number?
I was born on the 23rd of December. And 23 has been repeatedly been a lucky number for me. And about the title of my book, King of Travelers, that I did a lot of teaching overseas, and one place where I was teaching over in Pakistan, I was working with Afghan refugees from the war in Afghanistan, when the Russians were in Afghanistan. And I had one of my classes, English conversation classes, an evening class with, and almost everybody in that class, they were either a medical doctor or a PhD. And they called it the doctor's class. And they were very learned Islamic gentlemen, wonderful gentlemen, and we had wonderful discussions. And one of the things they told me about was a wonderful Muslim traveler named Ibn Battuta. Ibn Battuta was from Tunisia in North Africa. And Ibn Battuta is the equivalent of Marco Polo for the Muslims. And Ibn Battuta traveled from Tunisia in North Africa to Egypt, to Arabia, to India, to China, and traveled for about 30 years. Ibn Battuta spent about a year and a half, by the way, in India, researching, guess what? And when Ibn Battuta was back home on his deathbed in Tunisia, that the story they told me was that some admirers came, and they said, Ibn Battuta, you're the greatest of all travelers. And the story was, Ibn Battuta sat up in his deathbed, and he smiled, and he shook his finger, and he said, no. He said, I am not the greatest traveler, but if you learn the truth about Hazrat Isa, Prophet Jesus, if you learn the truth about the life of Jesus, Jesus is King of Travelers. And the phrase King of Travelers, it stuck in my mind. So King of Travelers refers to Jesus, to Emmanuel.
What was his purpose to travel? Was he trying to get a message out, or was there another reason?
There was kind of all of the above. In other words, one of the important reasons was to learn and study and to grow. And just as we have to, when we need to get knowledge and information and so on, we have to go where that is, to a university or to a library or to archives or to wise men and women, and to learn from them, and to seek and to search. And that young Jesus, in my opinion, he was not magically getting the knowledge and wisdom by going for walks in the hills with classical music playing. The movie Ben-Hur is great, by the way, but anyway, I believe that he was studying, that he had the keen, burning desire to go to India. And incidentally, the document that I mentioned earlier by the Civil War chaplain, Levi Dowling, the document called The Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ, which is still in print. It's a wonderful book. And The Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ by Levi Dowling, that tells how that at the Feast of the Passover, when young Jesus was 12 years old, and he was his parents found him talking with the learned doctors of the Hebrew law.
I remember that story.
Yeah, one of them may have been the legendary figure Rabbi Hillel. And he was giving marvelous answers, and there was a small audience gathered around, and according to the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ by Levi Dowling, one of the people in the audience was a man from eastern India, from the state of Orissa in eastern India, and his name was Ravana, Prince Ravana. And there's another Ravana in Hindu mythology about from Sri Lanka that's a bad guy. But this wasn't that Ravana. This was a good prince, Ravana from Orissa in eastern India. And he became friends with Jesus and became friends with the Mother Mary and with the surrogate father, the substitute father, Joseph. And anyway, that became friends with him, took his entourage, this Prince Ravana from India, took his entourage to Nazareth and spent a week or longer in Nazareth and put on a feast and honored young Jesus and basically said that he would become his patron and take young Jesus with his entourage, with his caravan, back on the Silk Road, back to India to study and that Prince Ravana would be his patron. And Jesus was just chomping at the bits to go, according to the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ. And I think that's very plausible. In fact, as the Muslims say, inshallah, God willing, when I go back next time, the third time to India, I'm going to be going to the state of Orissa, among other places in eastern India. I'm going to go to Bhubaneswar, where the archives are, and I'm going to verify historically if 2,000 years ago a prince named Ravana did exist, and find historical records. And I'm also going to go to the Jagannath Temple that young Jesus spent about six years, Jagannath Temple.
That would be great to find out. Let's go west of the Rockies in California. Welcome to Coast. Hi there. Hello?
Hello. Hi, this is Bob in Salinas, California.
Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I just want to say go Rams for tomorrow night, first of all.
Well, let me tell you, they're 0-2. I don't know what's wrong with them.
And we need a little faith going there.
lots.
I was going to ask Edward, what's your interpretation of the portion of the Bible involving the rapture of the church and the rise of the Antichrist? I mean, what do you know about that?
Well, as a friend of, I respect people who believe in the rapture. A friend of mine in the Unity Church here, where I'm a member, in San Antonio, Texas, that he says, well, I believe in the rupture. I don't know if I believe in the rapture, but about the rapture, that my understanding is that that was something that Saul of Tarsus, who became Paul, significant part of the Pharisee beliefs was about the resurrection aspect, that the dead bones would take on flesh and arise out of the graves, and then would sail up into the air to a final judgment, and that Jesus was the first fruits of that, of the resurrection. And incidentally, let me point out something, that in the regular New Testament passages, we have, of course, Lazarus raised from the dead.
Right.
Now let me point out that in the Talmud of Emmanuel document, that does not take place about Lazarus being raised from the dead. But let me point this out, that some fundamentalist preachers I've heard them on television and elsewhere saying this, that once you are resurrected, you are no longer subject to death. That's right, brother. Once you're resurrected, you're no longer subject to death. Death has no dominion over you once you're resurrected. And I say to them, well, what about Lazarus? He was resurrected by Jesus, right? So he must still be walking around someplace. They said, well, it doesn't work that way. I say, well, what happened to Lazarus? Well, he died, finally. And then I said, well, if he died, well, that throws a monkey wrench into that whole squirrely stuff about the resurrection. You see what I'm getting at?
I do.
And anyway, that I have the highest regard and the highest respect for Jesus, for Emmanuel and his teachings, and about the rapture, that those Christians who believe in that and it's important for them, and they don't believe in reincarnation, I say that stick with what works for you. That just like the Casey readings, Casey was asked which Christian religion is the best one, and Casey said basically, listen to your heart, listen to your intuitive, find the Christian group that is most compatible with your beliefs, and get on with your spiritual growth, be seeking and searching. And meditation is very important.
Is there anything, and I'm not saying this in a condescending way to you, but there's anything in the Bible you believe?
Oh, many things. And many things. See, a lot of things escaped the censors and so on like that. There are many things that in the Bible which I believe. Yes.
But there are also many things you don't believe.
Correct. And just to tell you, basically, the teaching that Emmanuel was saying in the Talmud of Emmanuel, that the website, again, for Jim Deardorff in his marvelous research, tjresearch.info, and the Talmud of Emmanuel, that Emmanuel was explaining that above everything is what is called the creation. The creation is the omnipotent, vast, all-knowing, all-powerful aspect of this universal divinity that they call the creation. And within the creation, there are spiritually advanced men and women who are governors, who act as governors within the creation, governors over planetary systems with human life. And they are called, by the Pleiadians, they're called Ishwish or Ishrish, whether they're male or female. But these spiritually advanced men and women are what is referred to as God. And then this gets into a matter of semantics, a matter of word meanings, that Emmanuel was teaching that above everything is what is called the creation. Within the creation, there are these spiritually advanced men and women, these kings and queens of wisdom that we refer to as God, who are like governors over human planets.
So you do believe in 10 seconds or less, you do believe in a God.
Oh, you bet I do. You bet I do.
Hold that thought, because I want to talk with you about that and take more phone calls when we come back. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Now I'm falling where I've never been. My resistance is wearing thin.
Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Edward Martin, my guest. Edward, some of the miracles that we hear about in the Bible, Jesus walking on water, turning water into wine, one fish into many. Do you think any of those happened?
My understanding from the Talmud of Emmanuel is that many of them did happen. And in fact, the accounts, I was just looking back here through the Talmud of Emmanuel, some of them are more amazing even than the accounts that we have. That, for example, I was looking here about walking on the sea, and it's particularly, to me, striking and beautiful about that passage, the feeding of the 5,000. I'm looking at chapter 16 of the Talmud of Emmanuel, and and incidentally, may I mention just briefly that for, of course, we were talked earlier about Dr. Jim Deardorff, his research for the last 16 years about the Talmud of Emmanuel and his wonderful dedication and wonderful scholarly research, his website, tjresearch.info. And if listeners would like to order a copy of the Talmud of Emmanuel, it can be ordered from fifthworld.com. And that's like the number 5, fifthworld.com.
Okay.
And that's Granite Publishing in North Carolina. But anyway, fifthworld.com also is in the process of republishing Dr. Jim Deardorff's marvelous scholarly book, Celestial Teachings, which is that verse-by-verse comparison between Matthew and the Talmud of Emmanuel and all of the wonderful scholarly statements. I've even, about the book Celestial Teachings, I've given that to a number of ministers, and then later they've been angry. And I said, oh, you're angry because it's a bunch of baloney. And they said, no, it's angry because I can read this and I can tell that the Talmud of Emmanuel is the truth.
How big is that book?
It's about the size of my book. It's about around maybe 275 pages, 270, maybe something in that range, 200 and some odd, between 200 and 300 pages.
It's a pretty good size.
It's pretty good size and very readable and beautifully written, very thoughtful. It's called Celestial Teachings by Dr. James Deardorff.
And that's let's go back to the miracles, would you?
Okay, the miracles. That for example, the Talmud of Emmanuel, does not include the changing the water to wine, and it does include many of the healings. And, of course, that Emmanuel had tremendous
healing powers. It includes such things as the, for example, the feeding of the 5,000, and then the other feeding of the multitude. That's what's called a doublet. In other words, that the Pharisees dealing with the Logia document in about 105 A.D. After the death of Bishop Papias. In fact, we may even, I don't know if I should say, we may even know the name of that deacon of the early Christian church who did some of this altering and changing. But anyway, the feeding of the 5,000 is there, the walking on the sea, and I would say many of the miracles are
okay,
here at the
Talmud
of Mormon.
This is what confuses me.
Go ahead.
If a lot of these issues and episodes correlate with some in the Bible, why doesn't the resurrection then be the same?
Well, because that wasn't, according to Emmanuel, that was not what happened about the resurrection. That Emmanuel had prophesied, and I have a passage right here, that proclamation of the Passion, if I can just read briefly a couple of paragraphs here. This is in the Talmud of Emmanuel, and
paraphrase it for me.
What's that?
Paraphrase it for me.
Well, here we go. Chapter 18, here we go. However, it will not come to pass that I am killed, but while in a state of near death, I will be considered dead for 3 days and three nights. I will be placed in a rock tomb so that the sign of Jonah will be fulfilled. My friends from faraway India, who are well versed in the art of healing, will be my caretakers and will help me flee from the tomb on the third day so that I may then finish my mission among the people of India. It shall come to pass that I will attain a certain insight, increase my knowledge, and generate a new strength in spirit and consciousness. And that's on page 121 of the Talmud of Emmanuel. So it doesn't upset my Christian belief.
Now, and when do you think that was written?
It was written at the time of the events, and then it was stolen, as we talked about. Judah Iscariot, the son of Simeon, one of the high priests, he stole the original Talmud of Emmanuel, which means the spiritual teachings of Jesus. Talmud of Emmanuel stole the original document for 70 pieces of silver, and of course that was turned over to the high priest, who were looking for heresy. They were looking for heresy and blasphemy and reasons to have him crucified.
All right, let's go to Wildcard Caller in Minnesota. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on.
How you doing, Josh? How you doing, Edward?
Good.
Oh, Edward, yeah, first, I'd like to congratulate you, Edward, for being brave enough to come out with this stuff, because this is a very hard subject. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, you bet.
It's a very hard subject for people to grasp. First of all, I believe you. I believe in Christ. I believe in Muhammad. I believe in all that myself. I believe in God. Mm-hmm. But I was told as a young man, man wrote the Bible, so who knows what man rewrote. And I was told that very young, and I've always had the sense of other things since I was told that. And, George, help me out a little bit, if I can. You know, Christ, you know, Emmanuel, was a great man. And also, Edward, the serious thing, the dog star, I think I told George about a week ago, is also related to an African tribe called the Dogon tribe.
Exactly.
Hundreds of years.
Yeah, okay? You know, yes.
Yeah, so anyway, George,
yes.
Jesus, with all the things he did, I keep asking Edward, but all these miracles, just think. Now, the man was crossed for a few hours, whereas most prisoners on crosses were there for days on end. Mm-hmm. He was taken down almost, like I said, 3 hours, which is almost immediately.
Right.
And by the man having all these powers and near death and doing all these miracles, the Shroud of Turin, to me, is proof that he healed himself. He actually healed, he healed all these other people. He did all these miracles. Why wouldn't he not have the power to heal himself? And that's all. How about you, Edward? Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Stern.
That's a good point. I have the understanding that that was a big part of the healing that took place within the 3 days and three nights within the tomb. In other words, he was being ministered to by the healers from India, who were probably two or three people, and it could, for that matter, there could have been one or more women in that group of healers. We don't know, but certainly, I believe that a significant part of what he was doing in that recuperating time within the tomb was that he was also using his healing powers on himself. And I think that's perfectly understandable and perfectly okay.
What about the passage where he rose again into the clouds and off he went?
That gets into an interesting area there toward the end with his farewell, and I'll be looking right here. But basically, that with his farewell, you know what levitation is?
Yes.
For example, in the Billy Meyer case, that on some occasions, when Billy has met with Semyase and the others from the Pleiades, that on some occasions, that they've levitated him, that. Like they do with cargo, in other words, that made him weightless and it's like coming up a kind of fast elevator like that, and the passage here when Emmanuel is saying the farewell after the crucifixion, and they've met at a certain mountain up in Galilee where he told the people to meet, and after he gave his farewell, then guess how he left? Got levitated by Dad, you know, that Gabriel in his ship hovering there silently.
Well, I was going to say, do you think he was beamed aboard, Scotty?
They can do that, too. They can dematerialize people, and that's often done in the Meyer case. And, in fact, when Semyase's father, Ptah, normally visits Billy just at the stroke of midnight on Billy's birthday, February 3rd, like it turns from February 2nd to the 3rd, and like about 12:01, just as it turns 1 minute past midnight, Ptah, Semyase's father, he's a gentleman who looks about 70 years old, and he's around 700, and Ptah beams down into Billy's study there with the door locked and something like that, and materializes. In other words, that just like our voices go over the phone lines, and they're changed into electrical impulses and then reconstituted, travel through the ethers and get picked up by cell phones and reconstituted and are recognizable. Amazingly enough, with their technology, they can reconstitute, they can dismantle and then reconstitute human bodies. And in fact, that ties in with how they travel through hyperspace, that their crafts, the metal ships, their physical bodies, everything gets transformed into an energy configuration, gets attached to tachyons, and then sent through hyperspace, which is outside of the time-space continuum.
Let's go east of the Rockies in Ohio. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning.
Yes, good
morning. Are you there?
Good morning.
Yes, we are.
We are. We're here.
All of a sudden, I guess when you switched over to me, your volume went way down.
Okay, well, we hear you well.
WNE Radio 980, while I'm listening to you on. We don't get you the last hour here. After 5 o'clock, we don't get to hear the rest of the show.
Ah, okay.
You need to do something about that. I don't know what you can do about it, but right now, if I were listening to the radio, you wouldn't be on. You're doing a great job, George. I think you had a lot of credibility to the show. I really enjoy listening to you when Art's not there, and I just want to throw that in. A couple of comments, and then I'll get off, and then he can answer respond to me after I get off the phone. I'll listen to you on the radio.
Okay.
Well, the thing about Christianity, I'm a fundamentalist myself, and the whole basis of what we believe is on the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, and that we would have no way of salvation as a Christian if Christ had not died. You know, that's what we believe, and that's what, and even Christ, you know, before he died, made comments, I have to do this, you know, I have to go through with this, you know, and he asked his father, I don't want to do this, even right before he went on the cross, and I just can't hardly accept that it happened any other way except that, except if it hadn't happened that way, there would be no way of salvation for Christians today. There wouldn't be any Christianity today. That's what Christianity is about. The comment you made, I was thinking about it, that was my second point, about him rising up into the clouds in the hills of Galilee, while there was two angels standing there, and he said to the crowd, he said, "You men of Galilee, why are you standing gazing into the heavens?" He said, "This same Jesus is coming back the same way he left. He's coming back again, you know." So, you know, Edward, I think you're a real learned man. I respect what you're saying.
Thank you.
I just have a real hard time with the thing about Jesus not dying. I really believe that he did die. And the stone had been rolled away when they went back to check the grave. You know, when they found that he was gone, And a comment about the grave clothes I've heard from other scholars was that the grave clothes are still there. They hadn't been ripped off or anything. It was like he just dehydrated and just disappeared out of the grave clothes. So if you want to comment on that, I'll get off.
Okay, thanks for those questions. Go ahead, Edward.
Those are good questions, and I certainly respect the fundamentalist viewpoints, and I believe that everyone should be comfortable with their beliefs. My own conclusion about things is that the issue of salvation, that in our Christian cosmology, the way that Christianity has developed, the way it's been formed and developed, that the big ticket item is salvation, that is the being saved from hellfire, and the teaching basically that we have only the one life, and that then after that there's the judgment, and then it's either heaven or hell, and for eternity. And I certainly believe that as a young person, and I respect those who have that belief. That if we could take just for a moment this thought, that what if, let's say that Jesus, that Emmanuel, let's say that he died dead, stone dead,
mm-hmm.
and let's say that he just is in a near-death experience. There are people whose hearts stop beating, sometimes for minutes. There are people who have been, in fact, a lot of cases where some people have been pronounced dead by a medical doctor, and the body has been taken down to the hearse, been taken down to the mortuary area, and then a person, after supposedly it's too late, the person has come back to life.
I could buy that.
In other words, do we not let that person keep living? In other words, of course not. The person comes back to life. They describe the near-death experience, going down through the dark tunnel toward the wonderful white light. They describe meeting with angelic-type beings who tell them you have to return, you've got more things to do. And we never begrudge that person returning to life and going on and living their life and doing everything in life, eating, drinking, dancing, and lovemaking, everything else, or having more children or anything. And so it seems to me, I feel strange when I think, well, let's say that Jesus did die dead as a doornail, and he was dead for a while.
But wouldn't that be a resurrection?
Okay, but let's say, okay, then what's the problem with that? If he was resurrected and he came back to life, and it was physical life in his physical body, just mm-hmm. as Doubting Thomas touched his wounds,
sure.
And let's say he was alive in his physical body, can people begrudge him being alive in his physical body and wanting to stay alive and eat food? Like, and think about how he ate the fish. There with at the Sea of Galilee after the crucifixion, that he ate the fish. He said, "I'm hungry. Haven't you guys caught anything?" And they said, "No, I haven't caught a fish all night." And he said, "Throw your nets over the right side. You get a big catch." And they couldn't pull in all the fish. And then they made a fire and they cooked the fish, and they're all in high spirits. And then Emmanuel pulled the hood back and they saw it was him. And they said, "You're not dead. You're not dead," like that. They were so joyful, and they were all in good spirits, and he said, "Meet me at so-and-so mountain in so many days up in Galilee, and I'll give my farewell." But about Christianity with that linchpin attached with making the salvation issue the be-all and the end-all, and the salvation issue has to hinge upon the death, and it has to hinge upon the resurrection, and then all this mumbo-jumbo area about the resurrected body, but is it flesh? Is it real? Is it reconstituted flesh? Does it dematerialize and go into vapor? And gets into a whole area, well, about the salvation, that the reincarnation teaching that Emmanuel was giving in the Talmud of Emmanuel, he was explaining that each human soul goes through many, many human lifetimes, and that our purpose, we are eternal human spirits, human souls, which
until it reaches perfection.
Exactly, we go back to the creation.
That.
Exactly, we go back to the creation, and to make the salvation. You see, the perversion of it, as I understand in the early Christian church, was the Pharisee belief of only one lifetime, and then either eternal heaven or hell, and no in between.
Well, do you believe in heaven and hell?
I believe in the upper astral plane and the lower astral plane, and the upper astral...
Well, let's call the upper heaven the lower hell.
There's a pleasant upper astral plane where between lifetimes that some people get to spend some time before having to return to the schoolhouse of planet Earth. And then there's the lower astral plane, which lives up to all billing, as I understand. It's a horrible place. And about the near-death experiences, like there's Dr. Maurice Rawlings wrote a wonderful book, Beyond Death's Door. And unlike Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who dealt with people weeks or months or years after the near-death experience, that Dr. Maurice Rawlings wrote Beyond Death's Door. His experiences were immediate, and he said that he wrote that at least half of the people, it was like half and half, half of the people that came back from a near-death experience had been in a heaven place, and the other half had been in a horrific hell place, like a lake of fire.
Coast to Coast continues. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch that dial. This is Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. My guest, Edward Martin. Edward, do you believe in the devil?
I believe there are dark forces out there. The Talmud of Emmanuel does not focus on that. There are certainly dark forces out there, and my spiritual understanding is that it is far better for us to focus on positive things and focus on the positive aspects. It's just like modern psychology shows us that there used to be the in tall buildings, there used to be the statement that in case of fire, do not use elevators.
Right.
And the psychology shows us that we tend to skip the not out. The not comes out. In case of fire, use elevators. People panic. Now, the psychology shows us that what we should put, and you'll see the signs now in most tall buildings, they focus on what you should do. In case of fire, use stairs. You see what it is. Instead of focusing on the not, that is, the human mind will tend to drop the knot. And so instead we want to focus on what's positive. And when President Bush said about the war on terrorism that we will not fail, I felt like, oh no. In other words, the human mind will tend to drop the knot. But instead, we want to focus on the positive. We will win. So in the same sense about the devil and the dark forces, that my understanding is that the disincarnate spirits on the other side, there are some horrific ones. There are some very bad disincarnate spirits on the other side, and who are up to just downright evil and bad stuff.
And I was going to say that. There's no question that there's a lot of evil.
You bet. Absolutely. And we as human beings, if we are wise, just as in Star Wars, we will not be seduced by the dark side of the Force. And of course, if you remember an interesting little passage in Star Wars, that when you remember how that Luke Skywalker's hand was cut off by Darth Vader and he got the mechanical bionic hand, which is like future technology. It's like the Pleiadians have that, and they have their intelligent robots, cyborgs, and so on. But when Luke Skywalker cut off Darth Vader's right hand and saw the wires, then he knew what happened. He could figure out that as a young man, Darth Vader, Anakin Skywalker, his hand, right hand, was cut off in some cruel way, and he got that he was later told the big lie, which is the way that you defeat evil is by out-hating the haters, which is like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said that she hated the Nazis so much that for a while she was becoming like a Hitler within herself. And what we should not do is to give in to hatred, and we instead need to focus on the desired goal, which of course is love and service to humanity, and going upward on that upward spiral back toward the white light of Emmanuel, toward the white light of the creation, and focus on the positive things.
Well, I believe if you concentrate on evil, it's going to come back to you tenfold.
Oh, yeah. And sadly, and that's the karmic law. It's just like if you seek revenge, that you want to out-hurt the hurters. You want to do do bad to people who have hurt you, then the karma is going to come back on us. The Casey readings are full of that in such eloquent and beautiful ways. I'll just quickly tell a little story from the Casey readings about a couple back in the 1930s. The husband was confined to a wheelchair, and he was impotent, and his wife was beautiful and young and sexy, and she wanted to make love, and her husband could not. And what she was told in the reading by Casey was that several hundred years before, in the time of the Crusades in Europe, that they had been married again at that time. And what happened was that her husband was going off to the Holy Land for the Crusades for about maybe 3 years or something, and he, against the will of the wife, he had a metal chastity belt put onto the wife, onto her, you know, the loins, the private parts, and had it locked against his wife's will. And of course, that cold metal being on there for 3 years, you know what I'm saying, that was a horrible thing. And she swore that she would, even if her husband got killed in the Holy Land, she was going to get even with that SOB, one way or the other. And what happened was that promise of revenge got carried over into the 1930s, into that later lifetime when they were married. And so she had the opportunity, but she had grown spiritually in those hundreds of years, in the intervening lifetimes. She had grown spiritually, so her husband was in a wheelchair. She could have brought other men in and had sex with other men right on the carpet in front of her husband in the wheelchair, but she didn't. And she loved, and she forgave her husband, and she grew spiritually. We need to make wise choices.
First-time caller in Eugene, Oregon. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
Good. A couple of things. Who did he say John was the reincarnation of?
John was you're saying John the Baptist?
Yes, yes.
Right, of Elias.
And the biblical name would be what again?
If you look up the passage, just a minute, I can help you with that here. That Jesus was saying, he was saying to the disciples, who do men say that I am? And then the disciples were replying that some say that you are Elijah, or one of the prophets, that you've come back. And then he was saying to Simon Peter, who do you say that I am, Simon Barjona? And then Simon was replying, you are the Messiah. And then the statement was made, but Master, was it not prophesied that before the return of Elijah, that Elias must return? And Elijah was a past lifetime of Emmanuel, of Jesus. And then Emmanuel said, verily I say unto you, Elias has returned, and men did unto him as they would, and so they shall do unto me. And then the next verse says, and then the disciples understood that he spake to them of John the Baptist. In other words, to me, that's in our ordinary, in our regular synoptic gospels, in the regular Bible. And to me, that's a clear statement of reincarnation right there, that Elias was the reincarnation in that time was John the Baptist. You see what I'm saying?
Let's talk a little bit again about the second coming, Edward. Do you believe in that? That Jesus
yes.
will come back?
Absolutely. And incidentally, that our Muslim friends, that I'm friends with a lot of Muslims, I'm also friends with a lot of Jews and Buddhists and Hindus and other religions, but yes, I believe that he will come back.
Okay, let's go to Wildcard Caller in Alaska. You're on Coast to Coast. Hello there. Good morning.
Yes. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Mr. Martin, congratulations for all the good work that you've been doing.
Oh, you're welcome.
I've been following this research for a long time myself.
Very good.
And many years ago, I started asking questions such as who created God?
Right.
Why was he created?
Mm-hmm.
Why is he here, his mission, that sort of thing. And I managed to answer all those questions for myself.
Good.
Very much it falls in line with what you've been saying.
Truth.
You're a lot better on the terminology than I am.
Truth is one. That is for example, between the Casey material and the teachings from the Pleiadians and many other sources I see basically alignment. There's different terminology, there's different semantics, putting things in different phraseology and so on, but I see a great confluence, a great consistency in these teachings. Go ahead.
Still with us, Frank?
Yes, go ahead.
I guess he has moved on.
Well, he's a wise gentleman, I'm sure.
Let's go west of the Rockies in Idaho. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, boy. Sort of insomniac. Good morning, George, Edward.
Good morning.
Yeah, I don't think there was any question that that Christ was physically killed. I mean, after, of course, he died from crucifixion, they drove the spear into his side, remember, and shame the blood and the water.
It was a superficial wound, from what I found. But I respect your belief. Go ahead.
Well, whatever. I mean,
go ahead.
After all, when he walked through the wall in the upper chamber, his body was not as physical as we see fit. Our body's physical, and surely, when he was taken up in the presence of 500, I mean, these things were written in the lives of these witnesses.
And you say that he walked through the wall. He was also touched by Thomas, who touched the flesh.
Well, yes.
And go ahead.
But he had power over these dimensional changes.
And,
as he himself said, you know, he'll lay it down and he'll take it up again. But anyway, you know, I can't help but wonder, you know, as we see the world seems to be tumbling toward Armageddon again, and I surely hate to see our nation getting into an offensive war that could blow all out of proportions.
I'm so sad also.
But in any case, we feel that, you know, this Messiah ben Yeshua, as you go back to the book of Isaiah, and and look at these things, I mean, surely the witness is there. Look in Ezekiel. Surely this is the Christ. And, of course, you go to a Jewish encyclopedia, which I have, and you'll find they have him as a minor prophet.
Mm-hmm.
But he was more than that. He was the firstborn in the spirit, the only begotten in the flesh. And we have to, of course, this is the message of Christianity. This is the, as we would go to Muhammad. I mean, he has a section in the Quran concerning Mary and the Lord. And as we go to the Jewish scriptures, it's the Jewish scriptures which testify of him. But in any case, it is very interesting to see the people of the book, the believers in this world, at each other's throats. I think he would be very unhappy with all of us concerning
him. Exactly.
Why, Edward, is there so much hate? If people subscribe to everything that the caller's talking about, why is there so much hate on this planet?
It's a sad and terrible thing that the promoters of various religions have twisted the religious beliefs and the aims with the concept of exclusivity, kind of like we've cornered the truth. That's something that Emmanuel prophesied about in the Talmud of Emmanuel. At the time that he was being scourged and tortured, he specifically by name told about Muhammad, and he was saying that in the future, and of course we're talking about 700 years in the future from that time, that a great and wise prophet would arise by the name of Muhammad. He names the name Muhammad, and he explains that Muhammad's teachings will be of goodness and value, and they shall be of spiritual merit, but that his followers of the new religion based upon Muhammad's teaching will twist and distort those teachings into an evil cult, and much hatred shall be put into that mix. And sadly, interesting enough about what the gentleman who's just calling was saying, and I respect his beliefs, he was just saying about people of the book and so on, the educated, some of the educated people in Afghanistan, I've heard make the phrase Mardome Ba'injil, people of the book, Mardome Ba'kitab, in other words, the book referring to the unanimity of of Muslims, Christians, and Jews, that they're saying, in effect, that we have a common father, in a sense, whether it's Abraham, that is Abraham, and of course Isaac and Esau and so on like that. But in other words, the going back to the Old Testament, that in the view of some of the Afghan people, they, some of the wise ones say, well, why do Christians and Muslims and Jews hate each other? We're all people of the book.
Well, then that's a good question. First-time caller in Canada. You are on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Hello, Stuart.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I am a born-again Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the Bible every day, the Bible even now in front of my desk. And I know, George, too many people, and even, sorry, I have to tell you, even your guest now is way out from the line. A born-again Christian don't have to read any other book except the Holy Bible. And the Holy Spirit is teach for us for everything what we need. And the Lord, it is a hell and it is a heaven. And the Lord Jesus will be back very soon, maybe in a few years. I said less than 10 years will be back on this earth. And this earth is will be a very, very big war before he is, will be back.
Bradley.
And the Lord Jesus is established only one church. And he was talking about the Nicodemus.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you must be born again by the water and the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I have to tell you that this, all this religion, the Lord Jesus haven't got any business those religion.
Well, Edward, even if some people disagree with you, there seem to be a lot of similarities as well.
Oh, yes, and I certainly respect born-again Christians. I have a lot of friends who are born-again Christians, and I respect everyone's belief, and I know the gentleman who just called, that I know that his intentions are very sincere and good, and I'd say for everyone, stay with what works for you, and let's respect each other and get along.
If people want to get a little bit more information about this, we of course are linked right up with your website. But you recommend, because we do have two on Art's website. Of the two, do you recommend both of them?
I recommend both of them. I would remark that the TJResearch.info website, that's Dr. Jim Dierdorf's website. It's marvelous material about the Talmud of Emmanuel and related materials, and people can find out much more about the Billy Meyer case and so on. The TombofJesus.com. The website master is a black gentleman who was raised as a Catholic and who has converted to Islam, and that's a wonderful website with many wonderful color photos and connecting links and so on. I thought I'd just briefly mention that the name of my book again is King of Travelers, Jesus Lost Years in India. It can be ordered through mindbodyspiritonline.com. Can be ordered with credit card and so on. So that's mindbodyspiritonline.com.
And as you said, it's a pretty good sized book.
It's about 274 pages, around that. That not daunting. It's gotten wonderful reviews. It's user friendly. It's enjoyable. A lot of 62 photos in it, two maps instead of drawings, and it's got a lot of good reviews. Some other things, just incidentally, that if people want to look at the cover and the back cover and some of the contents, they can go to Amazon.com, which has just a limited supply of my book, but they have the graphics. I mean, they can see the cover and so on. Amazon.com. If you want to get my book from your local bookstore, go to your local bookstore, especially New Age or New